With a bit of a delay today, and that delay was all on me. Nothing to do with our guest today, Chef Ken Daniels. We had woke up to 12 degree weather this morning, and I won't bore you with the full story, but I ended up with a glove literally frozen on my hand and some other crap that needed to be taken care of because animals need care no matter what the weather is. You can't just take a day off when you got animals. That delayed me a bit, so I hit Ken up and said, hey, let's push this back a half hour. He's like, no problem. So it's all on Jack today anyway. What are we going to talk about today? We're going to talk about Ken's story, about how he became a chef, a sommelier, the things that he does, what his background is. But this actually came in from him, and I'm going to rip it off now and actually do it. His suggested title was Getting to Know Your Expert Counsel. And I think that's a really good endeavor. So this is going to start a series of shows like this where I'll be interviewing each expert counsel member. Now, some of our expert council members, literally, we found them because they were on the show a time or three, and then we added them to the council. But we've added some new people lately that have never been on the air other than expert council shows. And I don't think Ken's ever been on other than as an expert council member. And hopefully he'll come back because he just vanished from the studio. So we'll see if I can drag this intro out a little bit till he gets back on board. But I am going to try to give priority to people who have never been on the air first. So like I'll get Mike Melito on, right? And Ryan Stevens, some of these other folks that we've added recently have never been on the air. And then we'll try to bring in the people who have been on, but maybe not for a while. And then we'll bring the regulars on like Nicole Sauce, because we do something with her every week. But I think it'd be a good idea. And I think it'll spur more questions into the expert council because guys, the value of our expert council is pretty amazing. And the better you know them, the better we'll be able to get things done. Anyway, before we bring Ken on, I hope he's back in the studio. I don't know what happened. He just vanished. But let's go ahead and take care of our sponsors of the day first. Sponsor of the day number one is Start 9 Private Servers. Do you know that there's this mythical place called the cloud? Kamala Harris said it's somewhere up there. It's not somewhere up there. It's not a cloud. It's just somebody else's computer that you connect to through the internet. There is a problem with that, though. That means someone else is securing your data or failing to secure your data, or you're trusting them with your data. And they could decide they don't like you, so they delete you or delete your data or cut you off. And it has happened. Oh, but that's not all. There's also the fact that when your data is stored with everybody else's data in a great big giant pool, well, your data is more important now. Now it's more likely to have a data breach. Like, I'm not really going to invest a lot of time and effort as a hacker. AJ Harrison is saying hello, right? So if it's just AJ, and I'm not going to invest a lot of time and effort to hack into AJ's computer because it's one person. That data only has so much potential value. But if I can get the data of like 10,000 or a million or 10 million or 50 million, like some of these data breaches, that has value. That's what gets attacked. I can also with Start9 run my own Bitcoin node, run my own Lightning node, run my own private messenger service for just myself, my family, my friends, my community, and a whole bunch more. Basically, guys, if you can install apps on a smartphone, you can use this technology and take back your tech and take back your tech freedom. Next up today, JM Bullion. I'm a techie guy. I kind of am in some ways, and I like technical solutions. I also like old school solutions. And I actually founded the concept of, you know, modern survivalism on that duality, that we will learn land navigation, shooting an azimuth and back azimuth using a topographical map. That's good. But we also won't, like, not use a GPS. Like, both of these things have their place. When it comes to how you invest and where you store your wealth, I'm kind of into that duality as well. I'm not one of these people that's all in on precious metals or all in on, you know, something like Bitcoin. I believe in both. I believe that's true diversity. And I definitely recommend you consider stacking some silver and or gold. And I recommend JM Bullion. Yes, they are a show sponsor. Yes, they've been a show sponsor for like, I think 13 years, which is a damn long time in podcasting. But there's other reasons I recommend. Like if we stopped having them as a sponsor, as long as I didn't have another silver or gold sponsor, I'd still say to use them. Why? Well, they have the best price. It's the same silver, and they really take care of their customers, and they actually care. And the guy that owns the company actually cares. That's something I haven't found with other people who've asked to sponsor the show. Lear Capital asked to sponsor the show. These things are kind of huge. They're on Fox News all the time. I said no, right? Monix and Atmix have both approached the show at one time or another. No, I can't talk to the person that actually can make things happen, then you don't get to be a sponsor. So check out JM Bullion, and if you're an MSB member, they will also give you a discount, which is really cool. With that, Chef Ken has returned to the green room. I don't know where he went, but he was gone for a moment. But here he is, Chef Ken, man. Welcome to the Survival Podcast.
Jack, how we doing? Had a little power outage here. I think power grid kind of went down. I thought it was my computer, and then my battery kicked in, and then it went down. I need to check on my battery. I think I need to replace that battery.
So. Okay. So hopefully that doesn't happen again. You're not that far from me, are you?
No, I'm in New Braunfels, Texas, so about 4 hours south of you near San Antonio.
Oh, you're not getting hit as hard with this cold then.
But no, but we're babies down here. We're babies down here, and sometimes the power grid, people turn up to like 80 degrees or heaters. So.
Gotcha. So. All right, well, let's talk about a few things. But let's start off with, like, before you were even a chef, right? Yep. Like, let's go back, like, you're in high school spacing out in study hall or some shit. What was your professional life, and like, how did you get into cooking right away? Like, how did you end up on the path that you're on?
Yeah, I started cooking with my grandma years ago, and I loved it. I loved cooking. I think I'm in one of the past ENC episodes. I said that I regret not grabbing all that information from my grandma when I did. She passed away when I was younger, high school. I had really good grades. I excelled in science and math, and I kind of had aspirations to be an engineer. I just love science. And then 17 years old, my dad died. And so it kind of changed things. My mom and dad were married for 30 years. So it took, I decided to stay home and decided to go to culinary school, and it changed my world. I think, I never thought I would be in this position where I am right now in my career, but I'm having so much damn fun. I can't even complain about it. It's just, I couldn't imagine being an engineer stuck at a desk somewhere.
Yeah. I can understand that. I think there's a lot of people that get into cooking that they have that same gen. I started cooking with my grandma. Mm-hmm. I think that might be one of the most common things. Like, I'm not a chef. I never will be, but I love to cook, and I started cooking with my grandma. Both of them. I learned, you know, Italian cooking from one and Ukrainian, Slovakian cooking from the other. And I really got completely like the stuff I cook, they would be like, what the hell is that? Right. But that was where it started. I think that's true of so many people.
Yeah. It's, you know, she was really Southern style cooking. I mean, she came out of the, you know, World War II kind of era. So she taught me a lot of those real inexpensive ways to make things stretch. And I think my favorite dish from her was the chicken and dumplings. And real Southern style. And it's one of the recipes I wish I had. But, you know, we were living here in Texas. She lived out in a place called Bowie, Texas. And then at about 14 years old, my mom was from San Diego. And so she said to my dad, we need to go back home to San Diego. And so she dragged his ass back there. And I started going to high school out there. It was fun. I think it was great growing up here in Texas because, man, I remember we lived about 3 hours from a bus ride from town. And I remember getting off the bus and just grabbing my fishing pole and going fishing for largemouth bass or going out and grabbing my 22. I mean, I was probably 10 or 12 and grabbing my 22 or my 410 and going out and doing some hunting and then coming back home and then doing homework. And so it was a really fun way to grow up. And then as soon as I got to a point where I guess all the kids kind of in that time period where it's that kind of stuff just kind of gets boring. And you know, you're looking at drinking and drugs and girls and there's nothing else to do in a small town. They took my sister back to San Diego. And then that was just super fun. But I think I got a real good childhood growing up, learning how to do all the farming and all the homestead stuff my grandma did and cooking and hunting. It was just a great, great childhood. So.
You know, that's interesting because that's another thing that led me to cook as a kid. Like I would go out and kill a squirrel or I would go out and catch a bunch of fish or whatever. And my parents just, it wasn't that they wouldn't eat it at all. They wouldn't cook it.
Yeah.
Right. Like my dad was a workaholic. He usually came home about 9 o'clock at night. He wasn't going to cook shit. And my mom was like the kind of person that like cooking was brown some ground beef, throw a can of ragu on it and dump it on spaghetti.
Yep.
Right. So like, if I wanted to eat this stuff that I was actually as a kid willing to go out and work for, I had to learn how to cook it. And so like my whole cooking genesis revolved around the grill. Cause you cook fish, parents bitch.
Yep.
It's like you can spill in the sink and you can cook fish on the grill, right?
Yep.
It, neither one actually counts as causing a problem.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I my parents growing up, we owned a business. I remember being, God, when we were probably like 7 or 8 years old, I remember being in a mobile home that my parents bought. We were so poor. My parents bought it from a guy who used it for dogs and cats, and you could just smell, right? Somewhere along the lines, my mom and dad bought a business, and they grew that business tremendously. I mean, it was just huge. We had over 40, 50 employees in a town that was like 2,000 people, and we did really well, but it was a sewing factory. And so from early on, my dad and mom taught me how to sew and be a tailor.
Mm-hmm.
And make patterns. And I was at a young, it wasn't like go home and sit on your butt. It's we need your help in the shop. Come get some work in, you know, sweep the floors or get on the production line. And it was just a really, man, some of the things I've done, I go back to your episode about the polymath. I heard it and I was like, man, I can relate to this because there's so many things in my life that I've done or just kind of picked up that I feel like I'm a novice polymath, right? Where I like to learn stuff. And so it was just, but a really good childhood. So
very cool, man. So you became a chef and you took the classic, you know, culinary school and do the job, but then you like expanded into all these other areas. You became a sommelier and you got a lot of other credentials and things. And I don't think you did it so like, you could be the guy with the most initials after your name. There are people that take that mm-hmm. path. You did it for like pure education and other reasons. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I you know, it's funny. People assume that I went to culinary school, and I did. Then I dropped out because one of the mentors that I kind of started gravitating toward early on in my career, he said, "You need to get out of school. It's you're just wasting your money. You're not going to learn what you need to. You need to start apprenticing." And I did end up kind of going to school, but what happened was I dropped out of this larger school, a culinary school, and ended up apprenticing under this guy named Chef Murat Day. He's a really famous French chef, real hard ass old school chef.
Yeah.
And he was actually in San Diego at the time. His wife had cancer and he was just like killing time. And he's like, "Hey, I'm working at this really crappy culinary school. Do you want to be my student?" And I was like, sure. And so I basically was his one-on-one student apprentice under him for almost a year and a half. And as soon as another student came in, I was like, I'll see you guys later. And it went on to do some other things. But it was then that I realized the power of apprenticeship and the power of volunteering and the power of just going in and getting knowledge that people are willing to give, right? And so that's how I became a chef. Moving on, I went to, you know, I was interested in beer and stuff, and so I did some beer knowledge training and through Siebel Institute in Chicago. But even still today, like with the sommelier, all of that is apprentice based. There's no school for it, and mm-hmm. so you just kind of have to start humbling yourself. No matter how many titles I can get or credentials that I, you know, a lot of people care about, you just have to shut up and listen to people who know more than you and just work and put your nose to the grind and just get it done. And sometimes it's not glamorous. People ask, what the hell, why are you doing certain things? But when you walk away, you know so much more than people that ever learn in school. You know, like in this last year I did, my wife said, we do pretty well financially as far as business wise. And so she's like, well, you got to go do something this year. And I'm like, well, all right, well, let me see what I'm going to go do. I found a local creamery here in town and learned how to make professional cheese, like actual commercial grade cheese. And that was all apprenticeship. And I had to drive 3-4 hours to a dairy to grab milk every twice a week and 250 gallons at a time. And, you know, it's blazing hot in the summer and I didn't care and I don't care about my credentials. I'm sweating my ass off, but I did that just so I could get back in the next day and learn how to make blue cheese or learn how to make cheddar. And I think that's something that a lot of young people miss these days is you got to put the hard work in, even no matter how old you are. Jack, can't hear you.
Okay. I feel like we've deprived like maybe two generations at least with this educational mandate that has come completely backed by the school systems and by the state. And everybody thinks, like, I just hate all college and think anybody that spent 5 seconds in college is wrong. I don't. But did what you have your degree in, does it actually help you is what my question is. And apparently that's a horrible question to answer. But I also feel like this applies to every other form of education you can get, that people have equated, like, a credential with the right to a job. It seems absolutely asinine. You've worked in the industry, so you tell me if I'm wrong, but I feel like the average person goes to culinary school. They spend a lot of money and a lot of time to get through it. I'm not sure how. I think it's like 2 years for some of them or something like that. And they'd be 30, 40, 50,000 bucks or more. Then they go get a job. And they find getting their first job to be pretty easy. And you're going to work as a line cook. Total shit. The worst work there is for 14 to 16 bucks an hour right now. That's what you're going to get. If you are a young person willing to work and show up and not fuck up and be there, and you walk in with no experience right now and say, I will do whatever you need, and that kitchen needs somebody, they will make you a line cook making $14 to $16 an hour in the same shitty spot that you can work your way up through, and that's where you'll learn your actual craft. And the next place will give a fuck a lot more about that first job than they will about your culinary school. And hence, the culinary school just delayed your start in the industry by 2 years, sucked a bunch of time and money out of your life, and if it turns out you hate it then you're really fucked, because now you're typecast into that, whereas you could have just gave it a shot and seen, and you will likely end up in the same place, maybe quicker without school. That's how it feels to me.
Yeah, I you're absolutely right. I actually, when I'm doing my leadership training with chefs or management for restaurants, I actually tell chefs who are starting out, if you're in school, drop out. I'd rather you, because what happens is now granted, I'm not going to discredit schools, because they do teach you fundamentals and they do teach you things that are important. But there is this nose to the grindstone that you will never get in a school. Right. And I actually tell older individuals who want to become chefs to go to school, because there is a sense of vetting involved. Because let's say you're doing a career switch and you go, I want to be a chef, I want to go in the kitchen. It's tough to tell someone who's 50 to go in and grind in the dish pit or on a line to prove yourself, where you might be able to go to school, learn as much as you can, and by age alone, you might be able to get more opportunities. And I do
want
to
run higher or something.
Correct. Yeah, right, but it still does not take away that the necessity of, there's something pure about being in a kitchen with a team, working day in and day out, sweating, putting out good food. And this is where people get people wrong, is that you go into culinary school to think that you're going to be something like a Food Network chef, and you're making the same food every day on a line, every day. And there's hard to find creativity. There's hard to find life after 1 to 2 weeks. It's just the same thing. But there is this joy and family that you get from working in a kitchen team, if it's a good team, right? And so that's what I tell people. If they want to get into the game, if you're young, go and be a dishwasher and bust your ass dishwashing. And I did it. Tons of my friends who I consider better chefs than me, that's where they started, right? And so it sucks. And it's that term of embrace the suck, right? It's going to suck.
Yeah.
But do it. And this moment that one day that salad guy doesn't show up for work and chef goes, we need someone to step up, your ass better say, all right, I'm in. And you work your ass off, and you may not get pulled up immediately, but the next time the chef needs something, you're there. It takes time, but you learn so much that way. No school can teach you that. No school.
You know, one of my favorite places around here is a small regional chain called Gloria's. And I talked to the manager at the one location, and he told me, we pay dishwashers $18 an hour right now. We can't get enough.
Yep.
And that, to me, that boggles the mind. You could make, you're not going to like go buy a McMansion making 18 bucks an hour. But 18 bucks an hour isn't terrible money. And you could literally get your entry while you're being paid more money than I could imagine making when I was like the kind of age this person might be 18, 19 years old out of school. Like, and I get inflation adjustment all, but when I graduated high school, minimum wage was $3.15 or $3.35 an hour, I think. And I think like one of my first real jobs, W-2 jobs before the Army, was like, I was making big money because I made $450. So when I hear somebody say, like, I won't work for $18 an hour, but I'll go take a government loan to go to culinary school for 2 years and give these people $60,000 of my money so I can get a job. And I know full well you're not going to start for more money than you could right now. I just don't – my brain shuts down on this. It doesn't make sense to me anymore.
No, and really when I look at – you know, I pull back from my other – to my career, you look at attrition rate, you have less turnover in the dish pit than you do in like servers or the front of the house area. And one, you either get the career dishwasher that knows, and I hate to say it because I am, you know, Mexican, but you get the old school Mexican guys that want to be in there and just grind it out. And that's what they love to do. Those are my best employees, right? Because I trust them. They show up. I always say 90% of the job is just showing up. Get your ass here.
On time,
right? And so, but I look at it to spectrum where if I bring a new kid in who's like 18 or 19 and I'm consulting with a company, I say, put him with the old dishwasher first. I want the old dishwasher to give him a shit test, basically. I want him to put him through the ringer. And you find that most people, I will tell some of my chefs some days when I'm doing consulting, hey, I want you to go work the dish pit. And they're like, oh, chef, come on, what are you doing? And I'm like, just go. And sure enough, most times they come back to me and go, chef, that was awesome. And I go, why? He goes, I didn't have to think about shit. It was just, you know, one of those days, like every day I'm asking you to do more and more and more. And that, you know, today it was just listen to some music and just wash dishes. And it was fun. And when you look at it, I always tell my chefs and front of the house people, it's always about perspective. You can sit here and complain about the where you are or where you're not at. But if you look at it perspective wise, sometimes it's really great to be back there in the dish pit and just have a good job, be around good people. And so, to me, the dish pit is the heart of the restaurant for sure. And it's usually where I can either break most employees or find out who they really are.
Gotcha. Kind of like when you're doing personal training, that first workout, you put them through hell.
Oh, yeah.
If they make it, then you're worth. Now, the next workout's not even going to be that hard. I wanted to know if you wanted this before I invest in you, right? Like, let's kind of drift back over to the sommelier stuff.
Sure.
I think a lot of people don't know what a sommelier is. And, you know, like, it doesn't make sense. They don't realize, like, what the value of it is. Can you kind of explain what that is and how it can apply to way more than just wine?
Yeah, sommelier, really what you're considered is sommelier in French means servant of wine. And really what a sommelier is, what we're trained to do, and at my level, I'm a certified, so I'm ready to test for my advanced master. Before COVID, I was kind of primed and ready to take that test. And then as soon as COVID hit, it was not possible. But what a sommelier does is we're trained to know every law, every detail about every wine, including all spirits as well. A lot of people don't realize it carries over to spirits as well. From every region in the world down to taste and visually looking at it and to identify quality level and where it's from. So testing, you know, we have 3 whites, 3 reds. We have 12 minutes to identify wines. We have 12 minutes to identify where that wine comes from down to the year, the varietal and the location in the world and quality level. And that location has to be relatively what you would consider down to like a county level, right? So it's not just a large region. It has to be like Russian.
So it's not necessarily you can say this was made by XYZ Vineyard and the grapes were grown on the Western Hill. But if it was here, you'd be like, this is a Tarrant County wine.
Correct. There are times where wines just scream where they're coming from. And so you could say that does come from this hill. And that is kind of a weird thing. A lot of people think it's witchcraft and kind of weird. And really what it is, it's deductive reasoning. You have to learn where all the laws come from. And so once those, you have kind of the traditions of where wine's made and how it's made and traditional things, there's things called, AVAs and IPAs and all these different legal things that have to happen. You pick up a glass of wine and I know it's a Chardonnay and I'm not smelling any oak on it. And it's probably from the old world. That's probably a Chablis from Burgundy.
Okay.
I've just deductive reasoning. Now, obviously there's a lot more involved with it. You can tell an age of a wine by looking at something called rim variation from the color of the center of the wine to the edge of the glass. Different colors will tell you what year it is. It's again, there's no school. I think there might be a school for it now, but it's not really accredited. But there's, at my point, there, I've been 11 years now. There's no school for it.
There's a standards body, but the education's your responsibility.
Correct.
Okay. Correct. Yeah. I like that, actually. I think that would be the greatest way that we could modify education. These are the things you should know to say that you're this level of this thing. I don't care if it's welding or a sommelier, a chef. Mm-hmm. I don't care what it is. You go figure out how to learn it. What were they called? I have a bunch of college credits, but I never went to college. CLEP tests.
CLEP tests, yep.
Right? So, like, you would take these advanced courses in high school, or in some cases, I wouldn't even take the advanced course, and they'd say, well, for $25, you could take this test. I'm like, fuck, I'll do that. Like, because you got out of school to take the test? Like, yeah, okay. And like, I think I only failed one of, like, 15 of them I took when I was a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, like, that process makes a lot more sense to me, because I don't care where you went to school. I care what you know and what you could do.
Correct.
That's an interesting thing. That might be something that we need to build into some of our own education programs. That's kind of a cool way to be.
I will tell you, it was and still is one of the most humbling tests and exams I've ever taken. It is one of the most emotionally just and physically difficult tests. When I was done, I took it out in Tucson, because they only give it in certain areas of the year, part of the year. Okay. There was 36 people that went to test and only three passed. And there was individuals that I had studied with for about 2 years, a little under 2 years, who have taken it three times, and I nailed it on the first try.
No.
And so it is unforgiving. I went out on the casino floor, because it was in a big hotel casino in Tucson, and I literally dropped to my knees and cried, because I was just physically just exhausted. And I never have – at my level now, I never have to retake to this level. If you don't – at some point, if you don't pass a test or move on, you just lose everything.
Oh, okay.
So my level now, I'm
– You kind of locked in.
I'm certified now. I'm good. I don't ever have to take that damn test again unless I want to. So
yeah, you got what they call it in colleges, tenure.
Tenure, yeah.
You got tenure, yeah. Right? Okay,
yeah.
That's cool. I tell you, for people that think it's witchcraft or whatever, I just think it is developing, you know, the taste for it, or like with music, the ear for it. Like, there are people that would say shit to me like, well, I knew that was so-and-so playing that guitar in that song. And he was like a guest to the, you know, he wasn't the guy that usually played. And you're like, bullshit. And then you take that person and you find like the same guitar riff from three different people and say, which one is this guy? And they're like, that one. And they're right. And you're like, I don't have an effing clue what the difference in those three pieces of music are. They all sound the same to me, but they, a certain way that there's a scratch on a string or something. I actually think it would be easier to do that with wine than with music, to me anyway. I don't know what the fuck you're talking about, right? Like, that's welcome to the jungle. Yeah, that's Slash playing. I get it. But that's not Slash. See, that was actually, what the fuck are you talking about, right? That's like the guy from Dokken or something. And you're like, how do you know that? And they just do. And I think it's, do you have enough passion to dig that deep to find those differentials?
You know, the one thing that I will tell you, and I think we're at the workshop, and a lot of the guys were asking me at the fall workshop, was asking me, hey, aren't you drinking? It's funny, is I don't really drink that much. It turned into a widget to me.
Yeah.
I'm constantly evaluating, and reality, my life, most of the sommeliers focus on the wine portion. I focus more on the spirits portion, and I actually enjoy more the etymology and cultural aspects of spirits, and kind of learning about what we eat and drink spirit wise. And so it most guys just focus on the wine. I kind of did the wine, got through what I needed to do, learned, and I know a good amount of it. And I still know a lot of it, but I love spirits. I love learning about what we drink and why we did certain things throughout the history. And it's just, I love that. I never thought I would feel so happy with a credential like a sommelier. Everyone thinks of a sommelier as just like this pretentious, you know, jackass. It's like, you know, snobby in the restaurants. And don't get me wrong, there are tons.
It can be.
Oh, yeah. And I tend to be the black sheep amongst the somms in my community. You either love me or hate me, because I'm not cut from that same. I don't care about who you know and what you know. I just, you know, and so it's just been a great career though for me with that credential. So,
I got a great kind of like amateur sommelier story for you. We all know people that like either spirits or wine or something, they know more than the average person, but they're not down that road all the way. I used to have a guy that worked for me, and his wine cellar is probably worth more than my house.
Mm-hmm.
This guy would go to Europe every year and have cases shipped in and stuff, and he knew his shit, man, and it was his thing. And we were at a conference for a thing called Bixie, which is in the telecom industry. It was in Orlando in winter every year, probably about right now, because that way everybody could take tax-deductible trips to Florida in the winter.
Yeah.
And we're sitting there, and we set up a dinner that night with, like, our biggest lead consultant and architect and some other people that were involved, and we're at the table, and Al's at the head of the table, and we're ordering wine, and he's explaining the wine to everybody. Well, it wasn't Ruth Chris, but it was something like to that level.
Mm-hmm.
And they bring the glasses out, and they're the big red wine glasses, the Riddles glasses and all, and they set them down, and I'm like, I got to pee, so I go to the bathroom. So I'm loud, but this dude projects.
Yeah.
I'm in the bathroom taking a leak, and I can hear him at our table explaining shit to people. And he's explaining why the glasses are so big with red wine. And he's explaining that when you have your whole nose in the glass, everybody has a dominant nostril, just like you have a dominant hand.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I can't believe I'm listening to this while I'm at a urinal. And he goes through the whole thing. And he's like, but if you take and you smell with each side of your nose,
mm-hmm. You
can tell which one your dominant nostril is. So by now I'm walking out of the bathroom. The whole fucking restaurant, everybody that had a wine glass is going. And then they're looking at each other and nodding their heads. And I'm like, holy crap. And I think, like, that little thing right there, like, I've never forgotten that. I think that the whole point of this isn't that anybody's going to, because they work with a psalm and picking out a wine or something, that they're going to become that. But they're going to appreciate what they have more because they know what to look for. They know why this wine is different
and
what's different about it, or why this bourbon is different, or why this scotch is different. And they know the backstory. And then they're able to, when they have friends over or whatever, and they break out that expensive bottle and they pour some for everybody instead of saying, oh, just go get drunk because, you know, freaking Mad Dog 2020 will do that for you. Like, they're able to pass that information on. And I think that's part of what makes it really cool.
Yeah, you guys who attended that fall workshop this year got to experience a little bit of that. I did a little tasting of how I do bourbon, and it's very different from most people what they know how to drink bourbon. And there's no more joy than I have in my life when I see all you guys right afterwards going around to each other. Hey, you try this and try it this way. And it just warms my heart because in the end, I think it boils down to, like, you talk about credentials and everything. I could give two crap about my credentials. To me, it's about teaching and sharing the love I have of food and beverage to people.
Yeah.
And then seeing them share it with other people is even better. It's like, it just, you know, someone said to me, hey, you should really, like, try to, like, trademark or make monetize this way you do tasting. And I go, if I'm going to get rich from that, that's a joke. But I'd rather people just go out and just enjoy, understand why they enjoy what they enjoy. Right. There's so many times I tell people, you know, in high school, we just drink to get drunk. We drink whatever we can get. College, we got a little bit of money, so we're still getting that, you know, Mad Dog 2020 or, you know, just whatever we can get. Now we actually hopefully have enough money where we can start buying some good things. It's my job to teach people how to start drinking professionally, right? On a professional level.
Professionally drinking. I know what you mean. Like, if you're going to go out and spend $75 on a bottle of liquor instead of, you know, 25, if you don't get the value, like, then it's just braggery. It's like there was a big fad about 2 years ago where everybody was showing how big of a cube of tungsten they have on their desk.
Yeah.
And it's just because it's expensive. And the bigger your cube, the more money you could waste. Like, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But, like, you dug into the sommelier stuff, but mixology, brewing, cheese making, wine, whiskey, cannabis. Mm-hmm. Like, and to me, that like, would make a person better at all things food and beverage. And then it starts to also push you into the world of science. And I've told people forever, like, learn to cook, teach your kids to cook. If you homeschool, especially, cooking is science.
Yeah, man, go back. It really wasn't a goal for me to get as many credentials as I was going to get. It's just, it was just seeking knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
The more I learned and the more I learned about one topic, I found that it fed into another topic. And then this mixology thing was more of it was me taking my food knowledge and taking my spirits knowledge and going, how can I think like a chef and make cocktails? And, mm-hmm. started work as a consultant. I had access to people who were interested in my ideas, and I started making some cocktails and started developing menus. And they're like, "This is phenomenal. We've never seen this stuff before." And, you know, entered in some national contests and won first place for that, because I'm thinking like a chef. I'm not thinking beverage wise. I'm thinking culinary technique integrated into beverage. And mixology to me, there are bartenders far better than me. There are mixologists at bars working right now that are far faster than me. But design and concept of creation, I love what I do. And I seek knowledge from every aspect that I can find. This is even at that, again, I was talking to Nicole Coffee about, like, Nicole Sauce about what pH level was her coffee at and stuff. And like, it's because I'm trying to figure out ways to push things that no one else has tried. And sometimes do I get it wrong? All the time. I've got a shelf full of crap that I need to throw out, that's things that are just molded over and just horrible. But it is, when I get something right, it's fun and it's exciting. And the cannabis, by the way, the cannabis came about a few years back. This guy from Colorado came and said, I want to make I was at a wine convention, and I was speaking, and I got done. And he goes, "Hey, I was interested if you were interested in becoming a cannabis sommelier." And I'm like, "What the hell is that?" And he's like, "Look, we're just trying to take it away from the pothead mentality and trying to make it more refined with a suit and tie and everything." And I'm like, "But we want to use your sense of smell, your heightened sense of smell, to try to identify certain things and aspects." And I've probably got about 250 hours of scope time looking at different cannabis buds and different trichomes, and identifying age levels of trichomes based on color. I'm able now to pick up a flower and be able to smell what type of cannabis it is. If it's they call it sativa or indica, I call it narrow leafer, but it registers different in my nose. And so really what we've done, me and my buddy, we used to do dinners where we used to cook with it. And we would cook with it, and we invite people, and not everyone smokes weed, right? And some people want to experience it. So some people would be high as a kite after the first course, about 30 minutes later. And some people, they were still absorbing, so it'd be an hour later, and they'd be like, "Oh, I'm still feeling it." So we designed a way that we microdose along the way, that we take different, like, and we take you through the process of basically building the high and down. I don't even smoke weed that much. I do just to keep up with a little bit of the education. But really, it's for me is, again, it's educational to get people who are doing it. I need to be the professional that can give you the knowledge that you need when you're going to a dispensary or you want to do a dinner. I can give you the confidence of what you're doing is, and teach you how to be a better consumer. And so that was a fun kind of portion. A lot of the guys in my industry were like, "No, I don't want that. That's gonna put a tarnish on my SOM pin." And I'm like, "You're an idiot. Like, if people are doing it, I wanna be educated enough to help them."
Yeah, you're being a guide. That's the real purpose of it. It's not "I'm better than you." It's "Let me guide you through this." Like the way you taught us to taste spirits. Mm-hmm. I'd never done that before. I had no idea that I was doing it wrong, right? And it's like, I don't need to have every sip I ever take of a bourbon done that way, but I do it a lot more that way than the other way. And I don't know that we can really explain it on.
No, it's hard. Like
this, right? But it's about like keeping your mouth shut, basically, and not letting that oxygen hit the alcohol, you know, until after it's been swallowed, and you wait a while before you open your mouth and let that, and you don't get the burn. And because the burn's not there, you can discern the flavors better. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you find out that a lot of things, like a rye, which is what you did, that, you know, I like it, but a lot of people are like that sizzle that's in there, that it's a different burn. It's a different type of alcohol burn because the rye contributes to it. Like, it's not actually as rough as you think it is. It's just that you're basically setting it on chemical fire is what you're doing. And like, that was really cool to explore that. And then that made, when I would try a different whiskey or bourbon or a rye or whatever, like, it made that better because I could actually tell the difference on it without it being like, you know, tequila's tequila in some ways. Like, but like, God, I can't think of it now. There's one that like instantly I know what it is. And as soon as you know how to taste it, you start being able to do more of that.
Yep.
God, what is it? I can't think what it is. As soon as I stop trying, I'll remember.
You know, when I started working and started getting into more of the spirits world, I try to avoid spirits tasting, bourbon tasting with men. I try to focus on the women. And I'll tell you why. The men, it's a 50-50 shot whether their ego is going to get involved. Most men, they are concerned about how much they're spending, the brand that they have on the shelf, and they've been drinking whiskey long enough that they know what the hell they're doing. They don't need some specialist to come in to tell them. And that's fine. I'm never going to win the moment. If I do, awesome. But 50% of the men all that way, 50 are, dude, they're eager. They want to learn. They're, and I'm all about it. I'll tell you, most of the best tasters I've known in my industry are women. I can show them this technique. They can ask any question without any kind of like the bro club kind of like, oh, this is what you got to drink. This is what you got to do. It's for me bringing, just speaking as a professional in industry, it is a demographic that the beverage industry needs to focus on is women in whiskey, because most of the buyers are men. And so if we can get more women drinking whiskey, we're already seeing a downtick in whiskey sales in the industry just because of the economy and different things. But if we can get that market up, I think that would save a lot of issues in our industry. And so I try to focus on that, but I love teaching. I love that is, hearing you say that, Jack, just warms my heart, man. That's awesome. So,
and you kind of dove in at this level to like cheese making, tasting, and things like that as well, right?
Correct. So last year, I really started just putting my nose to the grindstone, learning how to do cheese. I am an apprentice at best. I to say that I know anything more than just barely getting started, but working, you know, one-on-one with a few really good cheesemakers that are professional cheesemakers and learning what I could. At this point now, it's just practice. It's getting in there and, you know, making cheese, pressing, letting it age and screwing up and feeling comfortable with, again, we were talking about this the other day. It was getting comfortable with fermentation. There's so many people in this world right now who the idea of fermentation is so lost on them and they're so scared of it. They think that they're going to somehow do something and kill themselves. I tell everybody, listen, you're going to taste when something's wrong. Like you're going to smell, you're going to know when something's wrong. And if you don't, this is my big caveat. If you don't know, we have the power of the internet that people didn't have 100 years ago, 50 years ago. You could easily say, hey guys, here's my cheese. Is this weird? And you have the power of the community to go, yeah, that looks funkin' weird. You need to toss that, you know, or you need to take a pH sample of that. And so, yeah, cheese making was one of those things that I'd never really thought about doing until last year. And I was like, that sounds like fun. I'm going to add that feather to my cap. And at that point, I fell in love with whey. I fell in love with milk in general and fell in love with the all of the applications that we can do in really any scenario with milk and cheese and butter and cream. And I mean, it's just, it's such an amazing resource that I think most people in this world don't know how to utilize.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, my wife with cheese, the sharper, the better. That's it. That's all I have to do is look for the oldest, most aged cheese in about two or three different types. You know, like cheddar, obviously, and a few other things. Like, it's amazing to me. There are some cheeses that you're like, nah, that's not really much flavor or whatever. You age it, the whole thing changes. Like, she loves Gouda, but man, an aged Gouda rivals a good aged cheddar, right? It's like,
she let me try a cheese when I was at the fall workshop, and I'm actually planning on, if I come back out to the workshop, I'm going to make some cheese for her that I think she'll love. She let me, she's from Sweden? No, Scandinavia?
She's Dutch.
Dutch. And she let me try this cheese. It had like coriander seed or something in it. It was just,
yeah, it's Leiden.
Yeah.
And it's got caraway seeds in it. And the magic with that cheese, like there are things like you think cutting something different doesn't matter, but it does.
Yeah.
And using one of those really thin pull where you pull and you cut the thin slice, but at the same time, you're fracturing the caraway. If you try that cheese as a chunk or a slice, the difference is huge. It's weird, but it's back to science. It's about the exposure and the surface area and the taste buds.
Mm-hmm. Like cutting an onion, right? Cutting it polar versus side to side, you get more onion flavor. No, I tried that cheese with her, and I thought, I was like, I'm going to try to make this. And so I'm looking for one of my buddies to send me some information on one, and I'm going to try to make it before we come out again. So should be fun.
It is a cool cheese. We order that because a little piece of it, like at wherever you can find it, is ridiculous. And so we order it by the half wheel, and I have to bust it into triangles and shrink wrap it so that it won't go bad. You also have mentioned already a little bit about like mentoring other people and young professionals and people that want a career in this industry. Can you talk a little about the advice you would give other than just, you know, go get a job dishwashing instead of going to culinary school, and maybe expand beyond just even being a chef? This is a massive industry. It's one of the biggest industries in the world.
Yeah.
You know, I tell my grandson all the time, I want you to keep trying to do your best at baseball, but you're probably not going to play in the major leagues. It's probably not going to happen because it's 1% of 1% that do, you know, and I explained to them the whole way, everything, like you're in high school and it's pretty much everybody that's any good at all is going to get on the team. And then you get shrunk down into college, and then it's a shrink down into minors, and it's a shrink down into majors. But that doesn't mean you can't have a career in sports.
Yeah.
Like there's so many different permeations of that. There's people that are they're announcers. There's people mm-hmm. that are writers. There's people that are trainers. There's people that are in, like one of my best friends from high school, he's a graphics designer, but he specializes in the sports industry. He's like some of the biggest colleges and professional teams in the world. He has the contract to do all their work now, and he never went to school.
Right?
You know, this is just a guy that like got out of school and like, I don't know what to do with myself, learned graphics design, and then worked his ass off and originally got one deal with Temple University.
Yeah.
And then just, you know, then it made it a lot easier to get into like a smaller college and go, hey, let me see what I can do for you because I work with Temple. And then that pushed back to larger schools. And next thing you know, he's in the pros and he's doing shit for like the freaking Miami, whatever the Heat, I guess, the whoever the freaking pro NBA team is for Miami. He's got them. He's got the Philadelphia 76ers. He's got all these people now because he started somewhere. So and like. You would think like, oh, I want to be in sports, graphic design for that. But no. And no. So this dude's hooked up, right? If he's in town and there's a game going on, he makes a phone call. He's getting in.
Yeah.
And he's like coming to like hang out with players and shit. So I think there's so many ways into an industry that's that large, or in the case of like the hospitality industry, it's massive.
Yeah. My consulting company, it's called Advanced Hospitality Group. I try to focus on young professionals who think they might want to be in the industry, and kind of usually when I'm working with a team, I have to break them first, especially in this generation. I have to this generation is very instant gratification. They want all of the knowledge without the wisdom, right? And so you know, I have to give them a little bit of a shit test and put them through some ringers. And I'm looking, I teach all of my leaders, you need to look at behaviors, right? It's a consistency over intensity. And if I have to give advice to someone who wants to be in this industry, I'd say, one, you have to really know why you want to be here, because the hospitality industry can be very hard. There are some Karens out there and other people out there who will consistently make you feel like no matter what you do, you're not enough. And you have to remember that you're there to be good to people. That's the only reason that you need to be in the food and beverage industry, hospitality, and it could be hotels, anything. You genuinely want to be good to people. And I'm going to be honest with you, Jack, I fucking hate people.
He's not like me.
I hate people. But when I'm being of service to people, when I'm being, there's nothing better than looking. Yeah. Thank you.
That is at 48 minutes, 42 seconds. If you want to know what it is on the audio, because we're not telling you.
My wife is in the industry too. She's a director of operations for a pretty large restaurant group. And we don't want to be around people when we're done. But when we are with the people that we're mentoring, that is all we care about. And because for so long, Jack, I had been trying. I guess I suffered from like imposter syndrome, where I'm on stage somewhere, I'm writing something on a magazine, and I'm thinking, why the fuck am I? Who am I to be writing this, right? And so, a lot of times, I felt like a lot of the knowledge I was grabbing was to kind of verify to myself that I was qualified in this industry. And eventually it became a little bit of a competition with myself as how much can I do, right? Holy crap. This is, oh my gosh. Right. And then what happened was, one of my mentors said, you need to stop. The competition is not going to stop. You've got to turn around and start helping people, start pulling people up and looking for the people that are going to be better than you. And that's what I started doing in like 2016, started doing the consulting, started working with young professionals. Number one, you've got to put your ego aside. Restaurant work, well, really any hospitality work. I don't care if you're, you know, cleaning dishes or a hotel worker or whatever you are. It's not about pride. You're not going to be sitting there on some stage. Where I'm at, I would say it's very rare to have the capacity to be on stage and people listening to you at a conference and writing things. It's just, I'm very lucky and very humbled by it. But most times I remember the guys that I'd work with on their line are still on a line somewhere, sweating and grueling it out. And I say, and really this comes from Bourdain a little bit, but there's this large number of misfits and people who have no direction in life find their way to hospitality, find their way to restaurants. Mm-hmm. Some of the best workers I've ever had have been convicts, drug addicts, reformed drug addicts, right? You know, kids or individuals who had aspirations to do better in school and do things, things didn't work out, so they just continued being a server. Ego, if again, it's back to perspective. If you take the ego out and you look at it, I've known some bartenders that own three houses because they've worked their ass off. They're making good money. They're making cash and they're able to fucking monetize it. And if they're smart about it, now they're actually set themselves up for larger things in this world. Right. And it's very rare you're going to find a 401k or any kind of retirement or benefits in restaurant industry most times. Right. Mm. So you really have to be dedicated to weather the bad times and not worry about, well, is this really what I should be doing? And do I want to be a doctor? My parents don't like what I do. I've made a very wonderful career in my life in this hospitality industry. And I think the number one thing I would tell anybody looking to get in this industry is know why you want to do it, be good to people, and take the ego out of it.
Mm.
And if you're selfless,
somebody that is a servant having a big ego and being successful at being a servant. And that's kind of where you're at. I mean, literally we call the people that bring you the food servers, but the whole industry is about service as a servant, right?
That's one of the big things my complaint with some of my colleagues. And again, I'm probably going to get crap from my boys, but sommeliers, they walk in, their chef's all puffed up. They think they're the greatest thing under the sun because they're the sommelier and they know wine and everything. And our title is literally wine servant. And you're not curing cancer. You're not doing any. You're literally picking a bottle of wine from somebody, pouring it. That's all you're doing. And so, I'll tell you one other story, Jack. I used to have big fucking head, man. I was just pompous as hell. And I remember when I started in 2016, I think it was. I was at this conference. I was listening to this lady, and this woman was writing just fervently, just crazy writing. And I go, oh, what are you writing? She goes, oh, I'm a writer for a magazine. And I go, oh, wow. And I said, hey, I've got – and I dabble in writing, right? So I was like, hey, I've got this article, this idea. Can I pitch it to you? And she's like, yeah. And so she goes, here's my email. And so I sent it, and she said, Ken, this is amazing. It was about gin, right? And she goes, Ken, this is amazing. Have you ever written before? And I go, no, this is like – she goes, can I put this in the January article? And I'm like, yeah. And she's like, I'm going to pay you $1 a word. And I'm like, well, great. How many words? She goes, 1,000 words. And I go, holy shit. I'm going to be a paid published writer in the industry. Holy crap.
Yeah.
So I go to all my buddies and I was like, guys, I'm a god. Look at me. The day of the article, the magazine hit the newsstand. I open it up and they misspelled my name.
It's not even a hard name.
No. And and it's my, they spelled it, Danny Daniels.
Danny Daniels.
And to this day, my close colleagues will always, hey, Denny, what's up?
Yeah.
As a constant reminder. But let me tell you, you go from being the king of the world to humble as hell. And I always think of that. I have that article up here on my wall. I just think of every time when I start thinking, hey, things are be too quick. You can humble yourself pretty quickly. So
you know that Roman generals would have, when they were riding after victories in their chariots in a parade.
Yeah,
they would have a servant that would stand next to them, and that servant would say to them as the crowd was cheering them on as they came in with their troops, "Remember that you will die."
No shit.
Right. That was like keeping the, you are not a god, you are a mortal man. Yeah. You are experiencing this incredible ecstasy right now. Don't get, and it was a servant. It was like basically an indentured slave.
Yeah.
That would have this role telling this general, remember too, that you will die.
Yeah.
Right. That's, and I think there's a lesson in that, you know, humble nature. Cause this dude, right. You know, maybe he's not curing cancer. This is like generals of that time did not sit back and watch the fight go on. This was steel on steel, mm-hmm. flesh on steel battles. Mm-hmm. And they were in that battle with their men, or they were no good as a general.
Mm-hmm.
And they had that, you know, humility, not humiliating, but humility experience designed into the system. And I think that we could use a little bit of that, because there is, like you mentioned, the younger generation. I'm not picking on them. I mean, when I started this show 16 years ago, I used to look like I was picking on millennials. And millennials are like on high blood pressure medication now and shit, right? Like, I mean, that's how much things have changed. And the more they change, the more they stay the same. But there is a certain amount of this, and it's less laziness. It's more the instant gratification. And I think it's what I call microwave society. Like, I did the thing, and I got the little star, and now I expect what's supposed to come after the star. And nobody told them, yeah, but what comes after the star is shit. You have to still work your way through. Like, the star is not enough, because I don't think it's their fault. I think that they went through school that way, that, well, you get the star and you go from kindergarten to first grade, and you get the star and you go to second grade. And then they're told the whole way through, from the time they're old enough to understand, you have to go to college. If you go to college, you're going to get a good job and make good mm-hmm. money, and it's totally worth doing. So they go to college. They have no idea what they really want to do. So they take some generic shit, or communications, or marketing, or whatever, or gender studies, or who the fuck knows what. And then they go out to get a job, and like, everybody's like, oh, you got a college degree. That's pretty.
Yep.
What can you do? I mean, you interview with somebody like me. You know, I had a guy that interviewed with me, and he had a marketing degree from SMU. That's a very expensive school. It's a pretty good program. Motherfucker couldn't have marketed water a person in the desert. Fortunately, that was the job he was interviewing for. He was interviewing for a job as a web developer. And he was very, in fact, the only reason I could afford him for that job is he wanted to live close to his house, because he had a baby coming, right? But if he had been looking for a marketing job, don't care. I cared about what he could do. When he said, here's 20 sites I developed, you're hired.
Yeah.
You did that and you'll work for this? Get him an offer letter. Let's not, like, there is a purpose to the grind, is I guess what I'm saying. Like, the grind is your friend. It's not your enemy. Or we stay in the military, embrace the suck.
Yeah.
Right? Like, there is a place for that. And the people that you see that aren't doing it and they're living well, you know, 99 of 100 of them embraced the suck to get there. Sure, some of them, maybe there was a nepotism thing, or they just got lucky or whatever. But it's the very, very small minority. And if you look at a cohort and you want to join it, then what you should be asking is, how did the vast majority of these people get to where they are? And then look at all their steps and say, which one of those steps can be eliminated? And which can't. And what you'll find is, like you said, with being a chef and working in restaurant industry, going to culinary school can be eliminated. The grind, it's not. It's not mm-hmm. on the list of things. You're not going to go to culinary school. I don't care where you go, Cordon Bleu, whatever the fuck it is, right? You can go to France and study in Paris and come in, and somebody's going to be like, okay, let me make you a sous chef of my, you know, $12 million a year turnover steakhouse. That's not happening. And then, you know, like a year later, the cooking channel's not calling you up like as the next Bobby Flay giving you a show. None of that shit's happening. You have to embrace the grind. And I don't care if you're a welder. I don't care if you're a farmer, right? If you're a farmer, you're going to start out with 50 chickens and a chicken tractor. You're not going to be Joel Salatin tomorrow.
No, it's crazy you say that. I when you're talking, I'm thinking about like the grind that I had. Like, you know, throughout all those credentials, I was still working as a manager or building myself up in restaurants as manager or GM or director of operations of different places, some really large national brands. And so, you know, you've got these guys who are coming out with you know, sommelier credentials, and then someone, literally people will go, here's my beverage program, can you run it? And these kids have no idea about business operations. And you know, part of my CV is my resume is, I used to be assistant general manager at the corporate headquarters of Dick's Last Resort, right? I've got a real sharp tongue, and I will tell you if you don't know what the fuck you're talking about very quickly.
Yeah.
And one of the things I'll do is that when I'm mentoring, I'll say something and it's like, you know, a paragraph. I'll be talking to a group and I'll look to somebody and say, what did I just say? And I want to know, are you listening or are you just glazed over? Because you should be listening. You should be. And trust me, when I put them out, point them out like that, they very rarely have that problem again. So it, I think you're right. I think there's a lot of instant gratification. I think there's, but I also think that, and we can move on to this topic because it's interesting how I'm integrating AI into my business right now with consulting, it's in the restaurant industry. People, when I've written a lot of like just SOPs and restaurant manuals and all these things in the past, and I've basically put them into an AI structure where I can start just saying, hey, I need you to write this for this concept and in my tone, yada, 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 and it'll spit something out for me. When I tell clients that I do that, that I integrate AI, they go, well, then what do we need you for?
Why don't you go try to do it yourself?
That's what I tell them. I say, yeah. Number one, I've got all of my stuff previously that I've written as a base. Number two, and this is what I tell every person that I'm mentoring, do not be afraid of AI, because there will never be a way for AI to cross that human portion. You've got to have somebody to take the tool and connect it with the human. Yeah. And I can hand all of my information that I do for consulting packet for whatever, I can hand it to somebody who does not have my experience and they don't know what to do with it. And so I find that AI has been just tremendously helpful. But I think that this youth group now, they're just constantly, okay, AI, okay, I got the information. They mistake information for wisdom.
Yeah, yeah. And on the AI thing, here's an example of why you can't do it yourself if you're not educated first and experienced first. I was working on building the PowerPoint decks for my next course yesterday. And I got to this one slide, and I'm like, it feels a little imbalanced, a little shallow. I want one more bullet point for it. So I asked ChatGPT, can you give me one more bullet point on the slide? And it's all buckled into a project. So it's got the whole history. It knows what I'm doing. And it gave me a bullet point. It sounded really good. And I said, I'm literally like talking to it like it's a person. That's a great one, except for one fucking problem. That's not true. And then it does the whole thing where it's like, oh, fuck, what do I do now? And it comes back and goes, you're correct. Like, and it was about like, how long it persisted in the ground, and like this one persists longer than that one. I'm like, it doesn't matter. For the sake of a human lifetime, they're all infinite.
Mm-hmm.
So then it came up with another one. So if you don't know that and you build that into a presentation, either you're making a critical error in your assumptions, or if you're going to go fucking present it to somebody else and they're smart and you're not to that subject, now you look like a fucking terminal dumbass because you just said something that anybody that's really informed would know. That's not true.
Yeah.
And the problem with that, when you're at a professional role talking to other professionals, is now it doesn't matter if it's the only thing you were wrong about.
Yeah.
You've discredited every fucking thing you say after that. I don't want to hear from this person. Yeah. This person's a clown. They're a fake. They're a fraud. And sometimes it can happen naturally. But if you're just going to rely on a tool without having some level of intellectual check on it, because that's almost like saying, well, if you used Excel to do this, what the fuck do I need an engineer for? Right? It's the same mindset. It's just a new tool. And it requires the operator. I know people, you can put them behind an excavator. You can take a welder and spot weld a little freaking teaspoon on one tooth of a 30-ton excavator, take an egg, and stick it in a bucket of sand, and they can pull that egg out with that spoon and not break that egg. Just because you have an excavator doesn't make you that operator. And that will never change. It will still be like, if we make the ultimate tool that can do like be 99.9% accurate, it's still going to be the operator that makes the result better. And that's something people need to learn. And I'm interested in your thoughts on that, but I'm going to put you solo mode for like 1 minute. I have to do something behind the desk. I'm not gone, but roll till I get back.
Yeah, you know, we were talking about the AI issue, where the issue too is when I come across clients that they're seeking my services and they want to trust what you're bringing to them, and then they're saying there's no way that he could have all of this information written for us in the time that it's spent, and because I'm pushing all this information in front of them, and they're looking at you like, well, you know, how do we trust this information? And then I think the biggest thing with consulting that I've learned is I treat most of my clients almost like children, because I always tell them, being an entrepreneur does not make you a leader, and being able to integrate systems and things into place, most people are not qualified to do that when they start a business. And so I've been having a wonderful career as a consultant. And the other thing I do too, as part of my consulting, is I do large scale, festival formatting. So I'll do project management for, one of my mentors taught me along the way was doing large scale format, project management, kind of, event management and coordination for anything up to about 50,000 people. So I was trained early on first as a chef to oversee food operations for things around 1,000 to 5,000 people. Mm. And then when I got my beverage credentials, I met up with another one of my mentors. And I'll talk about mentors in a second, but she pushed me to start doing these large ones, 20, 30,000. Now it's not me solely. It's a team of people, right?
Of course it is.
But it's one of those things where, you know, we do it normally in Vegas or large convention centers, and you walk away when you serve, you know, 15,000 people in 4 hours, the amount of logistical, just science, engineering behind it, right? Where I've got, you know, we'll have a big event for 50,000 people. It's going to take place next year. I know that we'll start building out menus for VIP members and the general population of that convention or whatever it is. And I'll say, okay, I need 80,000 pounds of ribeye.
Yeah.
Right. I also need another 100,000 pounds of ground beef. And because you've got to feed these people 3 to 4 times a day, 50,000 people for usually 4 days. So we get on the horn with distributors and suppliers and say, hey, we're buying futures now of beef, and we've got to get everybody integrated. So the day of, you know, I'm on the horn. Usually my left ear has all my food and all my beverage on the right ear. Yeah. And I'm calling in, hey, we've got 16, 18 wheelers coming in the next 2 hours for protein. And now we've got another 6 for dairy. And then it's just a logistical, it's like you're conducting, right? Boom, 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 boom. But to see it kind of just happen, and people eat and they're happy and the chefs are making all their food. And so really in my career now, Jack, is I rarely cook anymore. I mean,
yeah.
I'm at a point now where I'm just consulting and really helping other leaders be better at what they do. And then I'll pick up some of these larger events as another contractor, subcontractor, and handle a certain portion and make really good money doing it. But I remember the last one we did was at the Palms Casino in Vegas, because it's a non-union hotel. I probably did 60,000 steps in one day.
Yeah.
Talk about pushing yourself. One of the cool things about my career that I don't really need to push that on people. Look what I can do. But
yeah,
engineering wise, it's pretty fun.
See, you know, you're hitting right now though on what I was thinking earlier when we were talking about culinary school and all. Like, let's say, because people come to me as an investor sometimes, and it'll be like, okay, well, what do you got? And let's say I had 2 restaurants, and I decided for some crazy fucking reason I wanted to be part owner in a restaurant chain or something. And I had one chef in front of me, and he like had the greatest pedigree as a chef you could have, like went to the Cordon Bleu, went to these other schools, trained under the best of the best, right? Like chef names I don't know, and I have to look up and go, oh shit, that's like Gordon Ramsay level, but beyond or whatever. 5 Michelin star shit. Like, and then I got the other guy, and he's like, well, let me tell you, I have an MBA and I have a Rolodex. Guess who the fuck I'm investing in? I don't need to hear another word. I don't care if that motherfucker can't make a peanut butter sandwich. What I know he can do is make a successful business, and he can hire somebody to make the food. right?
Yeah.
I'm not putting down the chef ability. I would prefer that guy knows how to cook and has a good taste and a good thought. But I know the guy that can make phone calls and get all that shit done you were talking about and more. I know the guy that can build a brand. I know a guy that can open, like, there's one in New York called Butter, right? Like, if you could take a brand like Butter and you could turn it into a place people wait to get in, they call ahead 3 weeks to get a seat at the table. Like, if you can do that, I'm interested from a monetary perspective. And it's not only about money, but without money, the whole thing falls apart. Like, most people that open a restaurant go broke, right? That's just a flat reality. And most people that are successful with a restaurant, the only way they get really successful, unless they do something like you do with, like, coordinating events and all, they get one restaurant up and running enough to not go out of business when they walk away, and they open another restaurant. By the time they get about three or four going, now they can actually make a living as, like, an overseer. But with one, you're just an employee right next to your guys.
Yeah. You say that. I always tell owners that when I go in for a consultation, number one, whenever I do consultation, I never ask. They ask me. I don't fish for business. They come to me because the dynamic's different. When they're asking for my help versus me, I can do this for you. And So I tell them, look, you have a chef and he's a great chef, but you got to think about the personality. I'm big about personalities and examining people's just who they are. Most chefs are very introverted people and they learn a very technical skill either through grind or through just general promotion, whatever. And then you hand them a piece of paper and say, I need you to build a team or build a business. And they don't know their ass in their head. They do not know. It takes, again, a little charisma. It takes a little finesse. It takes a little bit of everything. And they're very interested. All they want to do is they just want to chop and they want to yell and they wonder why they cannot connect with their team. It's because they're very technical driven and they don't understand why people don't get it. And I tell them, look, you're a business owner. You either need to be an entrepreneur or you need to be a leader. You cannot be both.
Yeah.
And most entrepreneurs are not leaders. And so I come in, I basically show them all the shit that they don't want to see and hear. And if they like it, okay. If they don't, that's fine. But it takes time to get in there to show them what authentic leadership is, right? And that's really my bread and butter is that I go to these small and medium sized companies, just like you said, who have one business, who are making the cash flows good. Their margins are good. Their brand is good. I hate coming into a brand that I've got to build and people eat in seats. Yeah. I like working. Obviously, it's easier, right? My job is to get them to that next level, either through outside franchise funding or in their own portfolio and investing more money in their own business. But my job is to get a standardization through, you know, they come in and they start a mom and pop place, but they don't have employee handbooks. They don't have training manuals. They don't have any black and white way to structure their brand. And to think that you're going to replicate that without any kind of systems at another location, you're stupid.
Yeah, there's a fundamental business principle in there that people that are highly technical and even if it's not something they were taught, but they developed a system or they developed, like, with a chef, a plate, and I want it to look like this, and I want this little green sauce in my squeeze bottle on the edge of the plate to have this little arc in it at the end, and I want three of those arcs, and they need to be equidistant, and you care about that. Guess what? All the fucking people you're going to hire don't.
No.
Right. You're fucking passionate about what you created. It's like an artist trying to tell another artist to paint the fucking picture exactly the same way. And to me, the only way you'll ever get that is to make that person understand why it's important. You can't just show them how to do it and expect that they'll think it's important because you said so. You have to understand why this is what it looks like when you put it together this way. And this is why we put it together that way. And this causes the person when it's set down in front of them to have this moment. And that's what keeps the lights on. And that keeps all of us paid.
Yep.
Right. And if you can't have that conversation, you're probably going to fail.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it doesn't matter if it's cooking. It doesn't matter what it is. Like the biggest problem that people that are like kind of perfect for solo entrepreneurship have is to understand you will never have anybody work for you as good as you.
Yeah.
In that lane, but not necessarily. You might have somebody better at you than cooking or better at you than programming or whatever, but you will never have somebody as good as you at driving that business. And if they were, they wouldn't work for you. And if they are, they will only work for you for about a year and they'll go do it, right? They're only there for a time.
Yeah, I tell my owner, the owners I work for consulting wise, the first question I ask them right off the bat is, what's your exit strategy? And they go, what? What's your exit strategy? Because right now you're handcuffed to your business.
Mm-hmm.
You are structuring your business so that if you are no longer here or no longer in any capacity to be here, the business will fail. And that's something that either you are going to accept and that's what you're going to do, or you need to start working to find systems in order to remove yourself so that you can choose to come in and observe things the way you want to do, but you're not back there washing dishes because so-and-so didn't come in. I need you to be there driving entrepreneur sales. I don't need you to go back and run the line. I don't need you to serve.
That's fundamental, like Robert Kiyosaki shit, working on your business instead of in your business, right? It's that basic. And I think chefs are probably doctors too, like people that get egos. They tend to build that business that way on purpose, even though they don't know they're doing it, because they want to be that important. Mm-hmm. The problem with being that important, like you said, okay, now you're hurt. You got hurt. You weren't even hurt at work. You went home and your wife bitched that you left the Christmas lights on the roof and you didn't want to call a guy to do it. So you went up on the ladder fell over and you hurt your back and you can't work for 3 weeks. Your restaurant's going bankrupt or your business. Like, I don't care if it's a landscape business, whatever. Like, there is a place for this in the trenches with your troops early on when you need to do it, to bootstrap it up. But if you're not designing it, like you said, with that exit in mind, then what you have is a job. You don't have a business, and that means your business is not scalable. And if you absolutely know that and you absolutely want that, then go ahead. But I don't think most people realize that they're painting themselves in that box. You know, yeah. I hated running people. I hate people more than you, I think, as far as like I like people and I hate people at the same time. Right. It's the how many are there and what do I need to do with them that makes me either love them or hate them? It could be the same person. And so I went solo for my own benefit. But when I was building businesses, I could go on vacation for 3 weeks and come back. The business was bigger than it was when I left.
Yeah.
And if you're going to build a business with a team in it, it better be that way, because you will find, for instance, that maybe your sous chef is making more money than you. Right. Because he's just on payroll. So he makes the same money every week and your cash flow is fluctuating when you have a bad week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I tell you this, growing out of the idea of working for someone into working for myself, but then trying to teach people how they can make money better at their business, right? Connecting people and basically just using all the connections I've gained in the industry has been the best thing for me. I don't typically wear an eye patch. I'm injured right now, but I'm not worried about work right now. I mean, you know, we've done very well making it so that I can step away for a month or two if I have to and not worry about that. And so how fucked up would it be if I'm telling people that I'm consulting for, don't handcuff yourself to the business when I'm doing it myself? That just makes no sense. And so luckily we've structured it. You know, the wife and I, we're both in the industry and people have come to us and said, hey, do you want to start a business? Do you want to start a restaurant? We're like, hell no. Hell no. We actually like being married to each other. We don't want to get divorced. And so I think things are good right now. I think came about, I'll kind of disclose. I just had an injury last week where I think it's complications of diabetes, because you guys know I've talked about before, damaged one of my nerves in my eye. And so I'm struggling right now to kind of figure out what the next step is and how I'm going to recover from this. And it kind of leads us into like what we're, you know, what I'm doing now and projects and stuff. You want to talk about that now or?
Yeah. Yeah. We can do that. I mean, I was actually going to go into your site next, Eat, Drink, Learn, because we're kind of at a high level business operational thing. And part of the reason you're on the expert council is because everybody eats. And a lot of these things that you learn at these high levels can then transcend down into the home kitchen. And I mean, just I've been asked before, like, let's say somebody took away everything you had and you had to start as a content creator again, what would you do? I'd probably do food, because it's like if I couldn't do what I do now and be this kind of generalist and I had to specialize in niche, it's what I love. And I love it because there is a lot of joy in it. You know, like my wife's pissing me off right now. Sorry, honey, but you are. Like, I made this chicken tortilla soup because she asked this weekend. Right. And I went, I mean, I made everything from scratch. I did like this pico that goes on it from scratch and use these special tomatoes and everything. And like, what I want to do for her is I want to take the bowl and put the soup in it and then stack these little strips I made on it and then put the thing and then the cilantro all around. I want to do it like it looks like it's in a restaurant. Yeah. She doesn't give a shit, right? Like, but she's like, man, this is like the best thing I ever ate. Well, that makes me happy anyway, right?
Yeah.
Like, and we can take these things. And what I've always said is like, don't even try to be a chef as a home cook. You can't. Julio's not coming in to make your stock at 4 o'clock in the morning. Okay. No. That's not happening. You don't have a line. No. You don't have like this militant setup of all these people with all these roles, right? You don't have somebody that's at, you know, at 12 o'clock at night getting the veal demi ready for tomorrow. Like, you don't have that shit. So I like, our classifications are like chef and then gourmet cook.
Yeah.
And gourmet cook is, I think, where people need to be. And we can borrow from the chef to do that. And that seems like kind of what you're teaching people at that site.
Yeah. You know, what's funny is I remember I was driving, not to make this long, but it's kind of a funny story. I was driving 3 to 4 hours twice a week getting milk to get this, do this cheese thing. And I'm listening. I'm able to listen to podcasts and books. And damn it, Jack, I've listened to you for a long ass time. I think I started listening to you right after you got out of the Jetta.
Okay.
And it's been a little while. And I've always listened and came back. And I always felt like you're that big brother that you hate that's right, but you come back to and you're like, God damn it, Jack, you were fucking right. Right. And so, you know, I had this time and I was listening, and one day you called back and go, I've got nothing but pikers right now. This is a call out for expert counsel if you're interested. And I was like, well, fuck it. I'm like driving and I'm like, all right, da-da-da-da, just fucking shut an email. And you're like, that sounds awesome. Can you do a 7-minute segment by tomorrow? And I'm like, fuck. All right. Well, I'm never one to not, you know, let's go for the challenge. Right. And so I get home and I tell the wife and she's like, holy shit. And so I literally just have no idea what the hell I'm doing. Audio, video, or anything like that. Audio, put something together. Cool. I just, and of course I love you, 'cause I'll say, I'm learning this about you, short and sweet. So I send it, you go, thanks. Nothing else. And I'm like, okay. And then sure enough, the next day, you go, Hey, this new guy's coming on. We're going to try him out. And I'm like, holy shit, I made it. And I was like, holy crap. Well, what you didn't know about that was I recorded that segment, got done about midnight, sent it to you. I think it was about midnight. The rest of the night I spent building drinkeatlearn.com. I had the domain.
Oh, wow.
And it originally was set up for me to do private tastings here locally in Texas.
Okay.
And I figured, I said, listen, if I'm going to be on the Survival Podcast, I want to have a place that I can send people that looks professional. I at least want to have something. If I'm going to get, even if this is just a one-time opportunity, I at least want to put it out there. I don't want to lose this opportunity. And so I did what I originally wanted to do with drinkeatlearn.com, was to build a place that I could have fun with things that I want to experiment with, but also teach. And I'm never one of lack to things to say. I talk a lot. That's just the curse of the psalm. I just, that's who I am. Two, I love experimenting with science and food and trying to be a little irreverent with some of the traditional things and push the limits other places. And I just started producing. And I think that's what it was, is just that, you know, people go, oh, what are you going to write about? I was like, I don't give a shit. I'm going to make sure that I'm going to produce something and just put it out there. And that's what happened. And I started, I got this huge list of things that I thought would be relevant to this community and start building. And that was the best one I had was probably the second one, was the bitters. I've gotten more feedback from the bitters one. In fact, that's what, you know, I am going to start doing some courses like you, and that the first one I'm building out is a bitters course.
Okay, cool.
And I think most people are going to, that's the most feedback I've gotten from anything I've done is bitters courses and how to make bitters. And I'm working on that right now for drinkeatlearn.com. So that is going to start happening. I will say that, you know, my mother had some medical issues the first of the year, and man, I feel a little bit behind, but the one thing I do tell people all the time is, even though there's setbacks in your life, just keep moving forward. Just keep pushing. And I keep thinking, I told my wife the other day, I was like, God, you know, this eye thing came about. What the hell am I going to do? And I was like, well, I'm going to fucking use it. So that's actually something I was going to bring up, Jack, is that I've had another domain that I've always wanted to do. I've had it for years, and it's called bloodsugarchef.com. And I think it's actually up if you want to pull it up. It's nothing crazy. But I want to start doing some outreach for diabetics who want to learn how to cook better, be better, but through the eyes of a chef that is diabetic, and make it more from a humanistic standpoint where I struggle, days I have that are bad, this eye thing that I've got going on. I think when I remember when I was started out in diabetes a few years ago, I would go to these like mandatory courses that you have to take once you get, and they tell you can't eat this, you can't eat this. And I'm a chef and I'm starting to freak out going, what the hell am I going to eat? Holy crap. And I start getting, and I get guilty after every meal that I ate because I felt like it was hurting my body. And obviously no matter how hard I try, this nerve thing happened. Right. And so, I want to do this website too. I think it's going to be really good. I've got some ideas for some workshops and some different things, but really what it's going to be is, kind of an inside look to my journey. Share the recipes, share the food, do some demos, and then just show you my struggles that I got with diabetes.
I don't have it up there right now is it's not coming up.
Uh-oh.
There it went. Okay. I don't know what was wrong. I don't know, maybe everybody went there in one shot or whatever. I don't know if it's your account. I found a Blood Sugar Chef on TikTok.
Yeah, some jerk has it on TikTok. I've got YouTube. I've got the website. Yeah. The idea though is I think that there is a large enough demographic of diabetic individuals who could use help, who could use the help of a chef. I think that it's something that I can share very easily. And I think I can integrate it with drinkeatlearn.com, kind of have like a sister site that, it, you know, have some fun, different things that how to reevaluate cooking, diabetically and drinking diabetically. I know that sounds weird. I know we talked, the reason why this came up was I had the ketone alcohol thing we were talking about.
Yeah.
But the other, I've been doing for the last week, I cut out all sugar, all tree, nut oil. I've eaten just kind of following a little bit of a low keto carb and
that's where you need to be. 'Cause you're type 2, right?
Correct.
Okay, yeah. I mean, that's exactly where you need to be. And I'll tell you who you need to talk to. And the name won't really surprise you, but the site might. Dr. Ken Berry.
Yeah, I was going to – we have his email. I was going to reach out to him. I wanted to – there's a lot of questions I have, and I know that he's been really wanting to start kind of bucking the traditional ADA kind of thing. And
well, I don't know if you know this. So the site I have up right now is the American Diabetes Society.
Ah, I didn't know
and
that.
And he's one of the backers and creators of this, and it's designed specifically to compete directly with the ADA, which is basically killing people, in my opinion. But people like you that need help, that what it's telling you to eat is exactly what you don't need to eat. If you have type 2 diabetes, you do not need to eat fucking cranberry oatmeal cookies for breakfast. I'm sorry. I don't care if it's only two. I don't care. You don't need to be eating that. That is not the food you need to live on. And that's coming through a partnership with a company called DaVita, who is in the dialysis industry and only makes a profit when you need dialysis. So I'm pretty sure they're not looking out for diabetics. And they are partnering on creating recipes. There may be you and Ken should talk, and there may be some partnership there, because what people are afraid of when you tell them to take away the carbs is like all the flavor's gone. Oh my God. You know what? No one goes to a vegetable house. They go to a steakhouse. You can take away the vegetables and the potatoes, but you can't take away the steak and have a steakhouse, right? There's a chop house. There's a steakhouse. There's not a lettuce house. There's a reason, right? And we can use so much. Like you give me beef, like four different cuts of beef. I can make you like 500 things and they're all low carb, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and some of them might have a little sugar in it, but just not stupid amounts. Like I just learned how to make al pastor, right? Oh, pork al pastor. Like I had no idea, like the pineapple and the layers and the whole thing. Like we went to a little taco place down in Fort Worth and we ordered, like my wife and I each ordered, like it was called wild salsa. So it was tacos wild. So you just pick three of their street tacos in one dish. And one of them was al pastor. And we're like, this is amazing. I'm like, I'll learn how to make this. And this is what I encourage people to do. Learn how to make shit. Like, all I did was just start looking at it, and then I looked at everybody's way of doing it and went, okay, fuck that. Now I'm going to take my instincts, and now that I know what it is, I'll make it myself. It came out fucking amazing.
Yeah.
And as long as you don't stick it on a tortilla, it's pretty damn low carb.
Yeah, last night we had I took some ground beef, some really high-fat ground beef,
yeah.
And I made Thai lettuce wraps, basically just fish, some fish sauce, a little soy sauce, and I put some mushrooms in there too. Now, the one thing I will say is I'm new as a chef. I'm new to cooking keto and carnivore, and
yeah.
I'm going to get it wrong. And that's kind of one that I want to make this side about is, look, you're not going to be perfect. But if you try and you just make an effort, I'm already seeing my numbers go down. And I was entered into the hospital on Saturday because of this. They had to do an MRI. And I remember waking up, and for breakfast, they gave me oatmeal. And I was like, what the fuck
Holy
is like, what the fuck is this? Like, they know I'm type 2. They know this is an issue. They know I'm having issues with it. And the issue too is that I think one of the things that kind of got me was, is I felt like based on my numbers that my diabetes was okay. And it just wasn't enough. My body, even though some of these numbers that they give out that you need to be under this A1C, clearly that's not good enough for my body. I've got to get it lower. And so as much as I do love the idea of having some American Diabetes Association telling us what to do, all the stuff that they told me to do wasn't correct. Well, it might be correct for somebody else.
No, it's
but,
not.
But
no,
my, it's not. No.
If you don't have diabetes and want it, oatmeal's your path, right?
Yeah.
For those that are on the audio only, which is most people, you know, verywell.com here, I have the surprising benefits of oatmeal for diabetes. What is the surprising benefit? That it kills your kidneys faster? That it makes you quicker to have your toe amputated? Like, what is the benefit of jacking up blood sugar for someone who has a problem with blood sugar?
Yeah.
Like, that is not, I mean, like, you're not hypoglycemic, right? You're not low blood sugar and trying to swing it back, right? Like, we're talking about people that are literally, you know, having serious health complications. And the solution is so simple that I think it's like explaining monetary creation. It repels the mind. It can't be that simple. This huge problem that affects millions of people, that costs billions of dollars a year, that does so much damage to people. The solution is don't eat carbohydrates. It can't be. But it is.
Yeah. I will tell you, though, and this is going to be a part of the website, is that, man, I'm having incredible cravings, right? I'm addicted to sugar, man. And
yes.
I have not had one fucking itty-bitty bounce of sugar. Other than, you know, just – I really haven't. I really haven't had any sugar, and my body is like, oh, my God, I'm craving it. I'm craving some bread, but no, I'm good. I don't want to have to go through this again, right? I don't want to deal with this. And if this is what it took for me, a wake-up call, they're saying 3 to 6 months that I should have some function back in my left
yeah.
eye. Man, it's I can't do this anymore. I can't play around with this anymore. So
you can't. Like, you're on that knife's edge where you either – decide you're not letting this happen, or you are,
yeah,
and you surrender. And I really like you, so I don't want you to take option B.
Well, right? this is the goal with really with drinkeatlearn.com and now Blood Sugar Chef is, I just love experimenting with things. I love having fun. I love teaching. I've been blown away by the amount of emails that I've gotten from drinkeatlearn.com. There's a guy, I think his name's Will. He did the eggnog. For his family and let one sit for a few weeks, like through Thanksgiving. And he said that it was one of the most amazing things. He took it to his neighborhood and they loved it. Man, that brings me so much joy when my recipe or something that they, you know, email back and say how much they loved it. And I'm gonna tell you right now, guys, in the community, I could be wrong. I do my best to try to vet everything I say to you. If I'm wrong, I'll always say I'm wrong. But man, I work hard every time I try to put something out to try to, one, have it connect with the community, and number two, to be authentic. And I'm not going to be 100%, but man, I've loved the opportunity to be a part of the expert council. It's been a blast.
Do you have some specific, like, long-term goals for Eat, Drink, Learn?
You know, the idea of doing these classes and these courses do seem interesting to me. I'll be honest with you, Jack, I'm at a point now where, professionally, I'm kind of searching what I want to do right now. The business has done really well. We're a lot of supplemental income has kind of been really good to us. And so I'm kind of interested in my next step in general. I enjoy mentoring. And if this is, you know, it could end up being Yeah. I mean, the courses seem like such a great way to connect with people. And I just want to make sure that it's, as you can imagine, there are 1,000 different recipe and cooking shows and things on YouTube and courses. And I don't necessarily want to have to be different, but I do want to make sure that I'm hitting a niche and I'm hitting something that I enjoy. And I think that's where I'm headed right now. And I think a lot of that too is going to be just conversing with you and your mentorship as well. You have a way of, not to kiss your ass, but you have a way of marketing and looking at things in a simple way that I've unfortunately have come to trust over the years. But in reality, I think that it's just this was out of nowhere. This expert council thing was out of nowhere. And it's been to be a part of your community as a listener for so long and now to give back. It's just, I'm humbled by it, right? I'm very humbled by it. And so, this new opportunity, I mean, it just started early last year. I don't know. I'm excited to see where it goes though.
You know, so one of the things I've worked with people a lot on is presentation, speaking, creating courses, things like that. And there's certain things you can do that will always work well. And this is why food fits it so well. When you're talking to people, if you can make them laugh at least once, you can make them, you can teach them something they didn't know that they find value in, and you can give them something to go do. If you can do those three things in any one presentation, you will be remembered by the people you spoke to. It's one of those things that's so fucking simple that you think it can't be that easy. You got to make them laugh at least once, you know, and that's not open with a knock knock joke or something. That's like built straight in, like you're flowing through and you drop this thing that like at first like two people go and then everybody laughs. Like it takes them a half a second to get it, like that kind of thing, and reinforce, and then you give them something to do. The beauty of cooking is you always give them something to do. And if you give them something to do and they go do it and it works, you're in their head for fucking ever.
Mm-hmm.
You're in their head forever. Like they'll like every time they do that thing, every time they make that thing, every time, like if you give them like something to cook and it becomes like one of their things that they make for friends, they're going to fucking talk about you every time they make it for friends. Because how did you, well, this guy, I learned it from him. Right. You know? And like, that is why this niche is so perfect. And if you want feedback from people, like people get excited when they cook something. People get excited when they do something and it works. And who really gets excited is a person that, like, every time I tried to do the thing, it failed, you know? And it can be something stupid, simple, like, hey, dummy, put salt on your fucking steak, stick it in the refrigerator for a few hours, take it out and dry it off before you hit that pan with it, and you'll get a sear. And they get, like, it's a soup. Like, and one of the things that we have to remember, and I don't care if it's cooking, I don't care where it is, like, as you develop over time, the shit you learned in the beginning that you got really excited about, right? The stuff in the middle and the end, a lot of people you're trying to help aren't ready for that yet. And that thing that you think is boring because you learned it 20 years ago from your British business partner like I did, like that's the most important thing is starting that walk. And it doesn't matter if it's podcasting, it's music, it's sports, it's cooking, it's making wine, it's making mead, it's growing a garden, it's making it doesn't matter what the fuck it is. It's those fundamental things that fundamentally alter. Like, well, everybody knows how to do this. Then why does yours suck? Let me show you three ways to make yours not suck. Right? This is why your steak's gray and my steak's brown. Right? I mean, I don't like to be that blunt, but that's exactly what I taught my grandson. My grandson can make a steak right now. I told him, I'd put that fucking New York strip on a menu at any fucking restaurant. Maybe not three forks, but you know, a decent steak place, right? Like you're not ready for three forks, buddy, but I don't know if you know that place, but it's, you know, they're sitting across the street from a Ruth Chris.
Yeah.
And the first time me and my business partner were in there, he's just that guy. He likes to drill people and he's British and all. And he says, what's the difference between this place and that place? He goes, we do $16 million of turnover a year in one restaurant. They do four. That was his fucking answer, right? And he was not ashamed to say it. Like, he's like, that's the difference. You want to go over there, go over there. And Neil's like, no, right? What do you got? There is like that level of that simple thing that transforms. Like, now, the person that learns to do that is never again going to make a great steak. You know, they're just not.
I will tell you right now, I keep referencing the fall workshop. It's obviously the first time I met you, and I did the presentation, and, you know, you come out and you go, I also think it was a little bit of a shit test to see what I would do, but you go, good presentation, but here are the three things you need to do better.
Yep.
And I'm like, okay. And you go, and I just listened, and I've had three presentations since then, and I've kept my PowerPoints minimal. I've kept them simple, and I've kept them the three things you told me to do. I've been getting a lot more feedback from them. I'm getting a lot more traction with it. And so again, you know, I know this is your show, but fuck, man, like, you just, the knowledge, again, it just goes back to the original point. Sometimes no matter how big you are, shut the fuck up and just start listening to people. Exactly. That's it. Yeah. Just shut up and start listening to people. And as you get older, you'll start recognizing, like you said, who are the bullshitters and who can I pick up information from? And, I tell you what, man, this has just been a blessing to be a part of the EC Expert Council. I hope it continues, man. I hope that, I can keep these topics coming and you guys love them. And it's just been a blast.
I think it's important for everybody. I try to do that. Like, what I realized when I started running sales teams, and I had, like, you know, 40 people, and I'm trying to make these people better presenters, that I fucking sucked at teaching people how to present. And the reason I fucking sucked at it is nobody taught me, and I just could. And I realized right there, like, I'm this guy McAndrew from the Army. So I tried to learn to play a guitar once. I never got good at it. I didn't really have the passion for it. I just wanted to be able to play basic acoustic, few chords, and sit around a campfire and be able to, like, play any song, because you can play any song even if it's not the song, right? You can make it work with rhythm. And I couldn't learn to do it. And the problem was, I picked a teacher that was me with presenting. He was the dude that picked up a guitar and was like, oh, I get this. And next thing you know, he's fucking jamming out, right? Mm-hmm. You can't learn from somebody like that. So I had to go to somebody to learn how to teach what I already knew how to do. That will bring you down a notch. But we all need to be brought down a notch at times, because, like, I had no idea. Like, well, why do you suck? Well, you didn't teach me how.
Yeah.
Right. You know, I made the deck for you. Why can't you present it? You saw me present it. Well, there's a technique for everything. And then there is levels of quality in everything. And not everybody's good at everything, but everybody can be good at some things. And, like, if you're going to be a leader and a teacher, then you have to be willing to reset to the basic to bring the person to the higher level. Like, it just won't work any other way, because you can't assume somebody knows don't throw a wet steak in a fucking frying pan, because most people do what? Throw a wet steak in a frying pan. Now you're steaming it, right? You're boiling it over a really thin layer of water. That's what you're doing. Yep. And, like, until I learned that, I didn't know. Like, I was like, why do I get a great sear on a grill, but I don't know frying pan? Well, the fucking water can fall off and fucking grill.
Yeah, one of my chefs always said, you're always stupid until you don't know. When you know, you're not stupid, right?
And so yeah.
It's true. People do stuff, and they just, because their grandma did it, or their mom did it, and they just think, oh, that's how you're supposed to do it. And again, it takes a little
humility. You know the old story about the roast with the end cut off?
No.
Okay, so dude, like, his wife makes a roast, and he looks at the roast, and she cuts the end off the roast and puts them both in the pan together. And he said, why do you do that? And she goes, I don't know. My mom always did it. So they call mom, and mom says, I don't know. Your grandma always did it. Grandma's still around, so they call grandma, and grandma says, my pan wasn't big enough. Right? Like, it's so classic that, like, because you saw it done a certain way, that means the way to do it. Like, maybe the reason it was even done that way has nothing to do with the world you're in today. Like, I always also say, like, you can't learn until you accept that you're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You have to know that you're wrong to learn. And I get people mad at me when I say that. I'm like, I don't understand why you're mad about that. Like, that applies to me too, not just you. Like, every time I learn something, especially, you know, one thing when you're like 15, maybe you're learning it because you were never exposed to it, so you're not technically wrong. But when you're 50, you've pretty much been exposed to everything. You're just wrong, right? You're just wrong. Like, there is a better way to do what you're doing. The thing you assumed that you knew, like the frog will sit in the pot while you turn the water heat up and not try to get out, is bullshit. Like, and then you tell somebody that and they get mad because they heard that boiling frog analogy. So that's not true. Fucking reptiles and amphibians thermoregulate, like, just like you do.
Yeah.
Right? Like that's not a thing. And they get so upset. But, you know, the old Kung Fu master thing with, you know, your cup is too full. I can't teach you until you come back to me with an empty cup. Because there's no place to put the new knowledge yet because you're too full of yourself. Like that, I think, is true of all of us. And I try, because I've spent so much time researching so many things and I've made a career out of teaching, mm-hmm. you have to check yourself once in a while and go, look, go learn something you don't like. Like, I'll do that sometimes. Like, I don't fucking have any interest in it. I'm going to go learn it anyway just to remind myself why you're good at what you do is you know things other people don't. And then you have to be careful the way you talk to people because if they knew what you knew, you wouldn't have any fucking purpose. Right. Yep. Like one of our old people that was part of our council and all, Steve Harris, like I had that conversation with him. You can't talk to people like you're fucking stupid because they ask you a question. Mm-hmm. And he just couldn't rock it. Like you would be useless if they knew the thing that you think they should know. They're coming to you for knowledge.
I was reading one of the comments that says, Ken, you can do it. Again, that's why I love this community. Everyone's so like supportive and just, well, there's some knuckleheads out there, but, your comment about, you know, when things get tough or even if they don't, this to me is one of the few things that, you know, you think about like this podcast, and I'm sure some of the highest rated ones are about the doomsday stuff and all like the world's going to end stuff. But for me, when times get tough and realistically in terms, it's this health. Yeah. Health to me is probably now going to be one of the toughest things that when times get tough. And I appreciate you having lifestyle stuff on your channel because mm-hmm. it helps realize that it's not just all these, you know, the world's going to, you know, all these doomsday idea of when you think of your podcast. I'm sure there's a branding thing that, you know, I wish you could probably go back and change a little bit, but doomsday
preppers. This the clunkiest fucking tagline. And I'm a great marketer. And I knew when I did it that it was clunky as fuck. And I'm like, but it's what it is.
Yeah.
Because my whole thing, like my school of thought was you should be able to distill down to three words you can present your business off of. And if you're really good, you can go to one. And like our old marketing firm, we were Franklin Spirico Media. And our entire brand was create. Small C, period, like a sentence, mm-hmm. create. And I could present the company off a business card. And that was on the back. So you had your name, your position, everything. All my employees had that on the back. It just said create, period. And I won't get into it, but it was even the material the card was made out of that we could walk into a client, hand them the card, and it was just the texture of it. The first thing I do is start rubbing their finger on it. And we had them made up without that special texture, and we'd hand them that when they were really stuck at the end of like they wanted to sign us or not. And see, can you tell me what the difference? Not really, but I like this one better. That's what we'll put in your business if you give us a chance. Right.
Oh, and that's like, awesome. Yeah.
That was like, and then I'm going to create this whole media thing and then like helping you live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. That's an intro. That's not a fucking tagline, but I'm like, there's a place where you break the rule, and that's when it's right to break the rule.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what that was like. No, I'll never change it out. Even though nobody gets it right. It's not like just do it. Right. Three words. Right. There's a reason Nike use just do it because it's just three words. And the mind mm-hmm. holds three words. The mind holds three things. The mind holds three with balance. Like that's always what I try to do. And I'm like, I can't do it with that because it won't be right. And it's probably the best bad decision I ever made. Even you get people that like listen to you for years and like I love your thing, and then they say it and it's like just butcher it. Like that proves I did it wrong but right.
You know, I think again the community though has just been so overwhelming. If this is a plug, but if you haven't gone to a workshop, I suggest you do. It was so fun. Meet such good people. I remember I annoyed the hell out of you because I forgot to sign up. I forgot to sign up. You go, make sure you sign up. And I'm like, oh, I totally forgot. But but it was just such a good time. And I learned so much and I appreciate it, Jack. I really do. So.
Well, I was grateful to have you there. And you ran a great little bagel bar for me. I was like, I'm going to throw this extra shit at this guy, you know. And but it worked out. It worked out really good. As an expert council member, where do you see – like, how can you best help people? What kind of things should they be asking about? Because it's a two-way street, guys. I tell the council members all the time, just make fucking content when you don't have a question. Just make something and send it to me. The other side of it is when you guys come to them, that's when we get the real magic, right? Like, so what do you want to hear from people, and how do you think you can help people?
Well, I'm going to tell you, be honest, I got, it never fails at the emails I get from the guys. I mean, I got the one from, for Haggis. I didn't realize I was going to do one for Haggis. Honestly, what I would love to see is if there's something that you want to learn food and beverage wise that you don't know, or let me tell you, Jack is a, I learn a lot from Jack just in general about some things, because Jack is a great, in my eyes, a chef, whether he likes to admit it or not. You got great culinary skills, but what I want to do is make sure that this community, it's a niche category for your audience, right? And so if there's things on a homestead in which maybe I don't know about, or maybe you're interested in, and share your interest with me, share your passion with me, because I might be able to connect it with something that you might have never thought of, or some, there might be some applications in the industry, food and beverage, that maybe someone hasn't connected the dots yet. So I always tell people, just reach out to me about things that you love, things that you're doing, things that you're experimenting with. You know, that's to me is the best part, is the community forum. I know that the Telegram channel, you know, I've been off it a little bit, but that to me is an awesome place where guys will just ask me questions and we'll get on topics and we'll just go about stuff. And, but I get to hear about what they care about, what they're interested in, what they want to learn. May not be an email, but I always tell people, just tell me what you're passionate about and let me connect the dots. I know that's kind of a weird way to look at it, but sometimes we can't see the forest despite the trees. Like, we're so doing what we're doing that maybe some outside person comes, hey, listen, I've seen that before in a food application. Hey, try this, right? And so my goal, though, every time I pick a question, or even if I'm making the question, is to try to connect it with the audience. And the audience is, I've got to remember, you guys are, you know, homesteaders, and there's a lifestyle thing that I want to connect. That's kind of where I want to be. And I guess I have a question for you, Jack, if that's okay.
Sure.
I've seen, just because I've listened to you for so long, I've seen a lot of chefs come and go in this expert council role. What do you feel like is going to be the best approach at this? Where do you think people have gone wrong with this?
So I say this, and I don't think you've ever gotten one of my ass whipping emails yet, but I say this into the whole group at times. When I was in the military, I had a drill sergeant in basic training, and you know, mail call would come and they'd pass out mail, and he would always say, men, if you want mail, send mail. And so my biggest advice to everybody on the council, if you go a week without a question, make a fucking segment, period. Don't wait. Make one. Perfect example, Mike Molito, Good Shepherd Training, wasn't getting many questions for him. Dude made a simple little segment going to very simple technical terms, right, last week. He's got six to eight questions. I can't in my head tell you exactly what the number is, but it's like every day I'm forwarding two freaking emails to him of new questions, because he put that content out there and people were like, oh, that opened up this other thing. I didn't know that gauge was based on how many balls of lead a certain size would fit in a thing, you know, like stuff like that. Like, that really helps people realize that it's not just one dimensional. So bringing alternative things to the table so that you're sending something, and when you send one, you usually get three back. And then that gives you more airtime. And the more airtime you get, the more questions you get. And the more questions you get, the more airtime you get. And then the more, it just feeds on itself. And then, you know, I hate to pick on him, but don't be Ken Berry and like go 4 months and then send all your shit to me in one go. And then I have you every week for like 12 weeks and then, and you disappear, right? That honestly, if Ken wasn't Ken, other Ken, he'd be kicked off.
Yeah.
Because he does that to me, and it hurts him more than it hurts me. Somebody will fill the gap, right?
Sure.
But if it's not you, then people forget about you, right? Like, that's why I do rewinds and shit when I leave and I go on vacation for 2 weeks and I just don't go dark for 2 weeks, because people get in the habit of doing things. And when you take away the habit, you take away the habitual behavior, and then they go spend their time in some other way. So that's what I would advise. And it's not really for you. That's for everybody. If you go a week or two without a question, make an answer. Just, I don't care if you, you can go, hey, I've just got this for you guys today, or you can invent a question. And I'll tell you who's great at it is Andy McCann. Andy McCann, he'll take his questions from other sources. And, like, I don't ever run out of material from him. So he doesn't really go maybe about once every 3 weeks I don't put him on just to make sure I keep the mix going. But Andy could not do anything for the next 5 weeks. I wouldn't notice. Right. And
yeah,
that
I think
is the key. Like, you have to treat it like anybody that's on the council or will ever be on the council. You have to treat it like you have a mini podcast. It has to be that important to you that nobody gave me an idea for a show this week. So I'm going to make one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think my bank is empty now, but I think I've been fairly
You've
well.
Been
I
good.
Just wanna, yeah. I try even during those tough times. I told you my mom had health issues. I'm like in the back. I was in the bathroom at the hospital.
I remember that one.
And I was crazy, but I appreciate you're right. And every time you put me on, I see hits on my website, and I see, and so it's I know people are reaching out to me, and it's one of those things where you put things out, and you don't know how, you don't have direct feedback as far as how it's going, and so. That's the one thing that as far as the expert council goes, you do it and you're like, I hope everybody liked that. And you just hope so.
Yeah. For you pikers out there listening too, I could use some more content for tomorrow. Just saying, like, I just got 3 from Melito. Right when I was saying that, I looked over there and he sent 3 in one email.
I figured you guys have enough of me today, so I didn't.
Yeah, no, that's why I'm just saying, like, some of you other guys, like, and I know Chris Rossini will come through with a Ron Paul segment. I'll have enough, but I'm thin, right? Like, when I'm done this week, I'll have a few in the bank, and they're all from Andy McCann, Melito, because he just got an avalanche and answered them, and Doc Bones. Like Doc is the other guy. Like, Doc's weird, man. I don't even know how he does what he does, because I will send him something, and I will have a segment back. Like, I'm batching my email, and by the time I'm done with my batch, there's his answer. And sometimes that fuck, he'll have sound effects in it and shit. Like, I'll tell you, here's a funny story. It has nothing to do with expert counsel directly, because they're close personal friends of ours, Bones and Amy. And Brian Black from ITS Tactical one day, he sent this thing around as like a joke, but it was somebody else's voice. And it was like, he sent it as a text audio file. And it said, "Hey, man, I just got pulled over, and the cops are going to take me to jail, you know, and they said they were looking for one badass and one retard. Well, they caught me, so you better pack up your helmet and your crayons and get the hell out of Dodge." So Dorothy and I were a few drinks into a bottle that night, and I made a version where it was my voice, and I sold it even harder, like, they're going to take my phone. I only got time to get this out as quick as I can, and I did the same thing. It was 15 minutes, and he sends back this thing, like this prison rape joke thing with the guy named Stallion, and there's a horse neighing in the background. I'm like, do you just sit around waiting to make shit? I don't know. But that's just there was another person who will remain nameless who literally, like, are you okay? Are you okay? He's like, you didn't get the fucking joke. Like, you didn't get the joke. And I had another guy's like, as soon as I heard it, I was like scamming on how to get you out of there. And then the joke came and he got it. But this other person was like, are you okay? Are you all right? Are you really in jail? Bro, I wouldn't be answering my phone if I was in jail, but thanks for
checking. That's hilarious.
But hey, man, I do have one question that came in for, actually, I got another.
Hey,
go ahead.
Yeah. Hey, real quick, Jack, speaking of hanging out, we're hanging out in March, right? March. 21st to 23rd or whatever it is. That should be pretty fun up there.
We are going to do.
Are you staying up there all 3 days or?
Yeah, I'm going to be there all the time. I don't know if I'll stay up there every night, but I probably will.
Yeah.
Let me get that up on the screen real quick here. And then I do have a couple questions we can hit.
Yeah.
But it's a beef processing class, March 21, 22, and 23. And it is about an hour north of my location. Ken's going to be there. He's going to be doing some really cool shit. I'll let him tell you what that is because I'll mess it up. But I'm just going to be there basically as an assistant instructor and to hang out and to be cool. Like, I'm not taking my portion of beef. I'm not taking a student spot so that a ticket can't be sold. And my grandson's actually going to be up there with me. So that'll be cool. He asked to go, and I'm like, hell yeah, you can go. And you want to tell him what you'll be doing there?
Yeah, so you know, they're going to be processing the beef. I'll be there just for shits and giggles, and a part of the beef processing. I it's always good for me to kind of see stuff again and catch on things. I haven't butchered a damn cow in forever, but it'd be good to see some different cuts and different things. But one, it's just helping out somebody in the TSP community. Number one, two. During the dinners, there's going to be another chef there that's going to be cooking, but I'm going to be flexing more of my beverage muscle there, and I'm going to be doing some. I'm bringing in some wine and probably some bourbon to do a dinner to kind of pair some stuff. And I'm going to teach people how to drink whiskey a little bit. Jack, I got a bottle of rum for you that I think you're going to love. Single barrel that I picked out. I think you're going to love that. So I think it's going to be just tons of fun up there, enjoying food and beverage, breaking bread together, and learning about butchering, which even as a chef, man, you just get out of practice. You get lazy and just order shit from the butcher, from the processor, and
yeah. You
forget how to break down some things sometimes. And you do it sometimes and you go, fuck, I hope no one looks at that because that was pretty mangled. It's mangled, man.
I've butchered some meat at times, and I don't mean in the traditional sense. I've jacked it up here and there. That's the beauty of it, though. Like, okay, that shit's going to the grinder or whatever, but like breaking down, like you get to do some stuff and you can get a hold of some things that you just can't buy, or, you know, you have to go out of your way to buy. And, you know, you can take a chuck roll and you can do some things with that most people never even, you know, think of, or everybody knows about chuck eyes now, but not everybody knows what a Denver steak is and stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, again, I've cut meat my whole life, but I'm not going as a student, but I am going to learn. Right. And I'm not going to, you know, when I say assistant instructor, I mean like, hey, do you need me to do something for you? That's what I mean. I don't mean to help teach. I want to learn too. And again, to learn, you have to take a step back and say, let me see how this person does this thing that I think I already know how to do. Because you might pick up one thing in that.
Yep.
And that can become a lifeline part of your skill set. Lifelong part of your skill set.
The one thing I'm going to do when I make time, when I go up there, is I want to go see Anton in Sunset. The Biltong.
Yeah.
He's right there next to that location. I want to go see him. I want to go see him. I told him I would. So,
you know, we'll have to do that too. My grandson's freaking hooked on that shit now.
It's good stuff.
Like, he always ate a little bit of it, but when he saw Anton make it, like, I think he went over and bought like 5 bags from him because you want to make money dishwashing. You need to be a 14-year-old kid at a TSP workshop washing the dishes. I think that kid raked in like $500 over 3 days.
Good kid, though.
Yeah, he's a good kid. I'm pretty proud of him. Let's take a few questions and then we'll wrap. Actually, we have 2 questions, and we have a super chat I want to say first. Gardens for Life sent me, I think that's €5. Thank you for that. I just appreciate it when people do that. No question came with it. This is an interesting one. Ian Sisk. Chef Ken, who are some of your favorite chefs? And I'm betting he means like that you see on Cooking Channel or whatever, because you can name some other people insiders, but if they don't know who they are, then I mean.
Yeah, I definitely have tons of insiders. I think probably one of the ones that most people know of that I'm incredibly fond of for many different reasons is Bourdain.
Okay.
To me, Bourdain, and it's funny, is not as a chef though, as a communicator, as a writer. He when I do my writings and when I do my articles, I try to channel his kind of, again, his irreverence that he has, and the way he speaks about the industry as a love versus just a duty. And to me, I do love that. You know, I could pick some people off of Food Network. They're all, to me, they're all the same. I like watching Food Network for ideas on what's happening in the industry, like trends that people are going to be looking for. But I really don't really spend much time watching those. I do like Gordon Ramsay just because he's a bit of a Muppet and just kind of No, I don't really follow much.
What I like about Gordon is when he's talking to a kid, he's he's like the NPC thing. Instead of put a nice chip in his head, he's like, you fucking idiot. You don't know anything. You're an idiot sandwich. Oh, honey, you just didn't get that quite right. Next time you need, like, How do you switch like that? You know,
I won't say who, but I have worked colleagues with one of his previous sous chefs.
Okay.
And his name came up and everything, and he's like, dude, he's the nicest guy you could ever freaking meet. Like, he's, when you're in the kitchen, it's brigade style, and it's definitely you got to make sure you're doing what you're doing. But he's one of the most genuine kind of guys that you could meet, and he really does get into mentorship. And so I like hearing that kind of stuff, because you don't want to believe that everyone's just a jackass.
You know, I like Bobby Flay's show, the Beat Bobby Flay show.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not so much that I really like him in particular that much, though I do respect the dude. I know there's some theatrics in it, and he doesn't not know at all, because you have to have some idea of what you're going to be doing. So I'm sure there's probably like each side submits a dish, and he knows in his head one of those is what he's going to do. But a dude that will go into a competition like that, where you're going to cook against this person that's been doing that their whole life, and maybe it's the first time you ever did it, that's impressive. But what I love about that show is I'll learn about one new ingredient.
Yeah.
I'll learn about one new dish. Like, it's the people he brings on. And if you take apart the WWE theatric shit, and you just look at like the person's background, how they learn to cook and what they're cooking, you know, I might, and I'll be honest, I get like, today we're going to have a bake-off, Skip. Like, I don't give a fuck. I don't care about making bread or cake or dessert or anything. But like, some of the, like, you learn these ethnic dishes. And to me, this is a way that you can like tie into cultures. Like, I'm not going to travel the world. Even if I do, I'm going to miss 90% of it. Like, you can experience cultures through their food. And so when I watch celebrity chefs or whatever, I'm way more interested in finding something I didn't know about. You know, one seasoning mix I didn't know existed or something like that. You know, like Ras Al Hanout, when I learned about that, I'm like, oh, fuck. I went out and I bought a whatever they're called, the clay thing.
Yeah.
The tangine. Right. Mm-hmm. Dried apricots, the whole thing. And I made it the way that it soaked the clay. And could I have made it a crock pot? Sure. But I wanted to learn the way that the person that first came up with it did it, or the way that it's traditionally done. And so when I watch shows like that, I'm more interested in that than the personality. Now, locally, probably my favorite chef is Tim Love. And his various restaurants. Just, it's different, and like realizing, and then the more you learn, the more you realize, like, he does this dish at Lonesome Dove that is like, it's an elk tenderloin, and it's done a certain way, and it's got maitake mushrooms and these candy grapes and this like Swiss chard done like a crisp and all. And I look at it and I'm like, oh, that's pretty cool. I order it. Every time I go there, that's what I get. And then one day I'm watching, I think it was Verdane. It was either him or Zimmerman. And they were over in Norway, and there's this traditional once a year thing they make from reindeer. And I'm like, it's the same fucking thing, but he Americanized it. And I got to meet him about 5 years ago at a thing down at Riata restaurant, where they brought all the chefs, the big chefs that came through Riata in to do like this 12 course thing. And he was there. And when I told him, I know what you did, he told me, he said, you're the first fucking person that ever figured that out.
That's awesome.
And now I know it was Andrew Zimmerman's show, because that's how I learned about Tim Love, was through Andrew Zimmerman.
Mm-hmm.
And so like that, all that connection to me, that's the cool thing about an industry like that.
Yeah. The other person that comes to mind real quickly is Alton Brown. He's not on anymore, but
I loved him.
For me, the science of it was just, I geeked out on it I go on HBO all the time now and just watch old episodes now.
It was fucking Mr. Wizard's world for adults that wanted to learn how to cook.
Yeah.
That's what, if you're old enough to remember Mr. Wizard's World on Nickelodeon, that's what that show was like. It was like the modern, like, and yeah, I really got a lot out of that show too. Real quick, this is a long answer. Yep. So let's try to short answer it. We're at 2 hours. Jeff T says, can you explain sous vide to me?
Yeah. So sous vide is really an old school technique that we've modernized with really cool kitchen tool now that, you basically submerge, you seal something in a bag and submerge it in water and it keeps a consistent temperature. And the most important part of that is it just holds at a consistent temperature. And so what really allows you to do in food science and just any kind of food technique is stoves are notoriously wicked for temperature variations. And you also get a lot of just moisture release and different things that are happening, whether you're doing sauteing or baking or roasting, whatever you're doing. cooking in water in a water bath that's consistent allows you to, number one, break down collagen fat and different things in meat in a sealed container, and it kind of just keeps everything nice and happy in there. I can keep meats at a temperature for longer without any deterioration or drying, which will allow me to hold and then sear later on. And then for beyond that is also just extraction purposes for me, for different things I'm using for bitters or for, I think one of the next topics I've got coming up on the Expert Council is like infusing, like vodkas with different flavors stuff. Mm. And it allows me to infuse things without going over 173 degrees, which would burn off alcohol. And there's just, I will tell people you almost cannot do wrong with sous vide. Try it. Go online. You can always reach out to me again, info@drinkeatlearn.com, but really go on and just get a vacuum sealer, grab a bag, throw something in a, put it in and just watch what happens. I say start with chicken and just let that sucker go. And just, you know, I say like dark meat, like thighs and stuff. And
like my favorite thing to do with it. Well, I have a ton of things I can do. Like one of the really cool things you can do with it is you take something like a brisket and set it to 135 degrees. So it's a very rare, like if you, nobody's ever eaten rare brisket because it would be like eating shoe leather. Right. Yeah. But you do a 48-hour 135 sous vide on a brisket. And before you do that, you cold smoke it for like 4 hours. After you cold smoke it with a good brine and all, then you cryovac it, you throw it in the refrigerator for a couple of days before you sous vide it. You take it out, you put it in the refrigerator, you cool it all the way back down, and you bust off pieces of it like it's steak, like 1-inch thick steak, and then you hard sear the outside of it. Now you have all that flavor of a brisket, and it eats like a steak, and it's got all that fat. And this, like, it's an insane thing. Like, you, no one's ever eaten a brisket cooked to 135. Like, mm-mm. Not enjoyed it, right? Mm-mm. But all of a sudden you can. Like, it'll rival a ribeye for tenderness, and it'll have more flavor. Like, and like the fact you can do shit like that, like, that's a science thing. And how did I learn that? Did I watch somebody do it on YouTube or not? No, I was just went, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. I know how to make a steak, and I know how to make a good brisket. What if? And the fun thing with cooking is, so you do what if. Sometimes you go, well, there's a reason nobody does that.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
But that particular instance, there was a reason to do it. And I don't know if you got to try the pork chops at the workshop, but those were done in a similar way. They were done with I made a sage salt, about half sage, fresh sage, half salt. Put them in a food processor together and let that dry out before I dry brined it with that and did a multi-day dry brine and then a sous vide and then seared off. Like, and you know, you're taking something that, and this is like the power of learning to cook is you can then cook for a lot of people cheap. So I was buying a whole pork loin, you know, so you got a 1-inch thick, this beautiful chop. You've got 75 cents a chop into it when you're feeding people. Like,
bro, I almost got sick on your damn sausage, man. That was so good. I was just like, I was like, I can't eat anymore. It was so damn good. Your sausages were out of this world, man. That chicken you did. Yeah, yeah, man, that was so good, man.
You know, I did three sausages. I expected the preponderance of the people to be one winner, and it was almost equal. It was about 1/3 each that like different ones. Some people love the pork apple. Some love the brisket. The brisket was like Texas barbecue meets chorizo in Spain. Right. And like when you do that the first time, there's a little bit like, this is my thing. If you want to be a great cook, don't be fucking afraid. Fuck it. Yeah. Try it. Make a little bit of it. And if it sucks, well, then it was a bad idea. Right. But if it's good or if it's then change until you figure it out. Like, and I'll tell you my biggest weakness is don't ask me for a recipe. I don't fucking know.
Well, that's what I was going to say, Jack, is that goes back to my expert counsel thing where people need to start writing shit down, right? If you try, if you do something, you really want to get better at it, write it down. Write what you did down and then don't do it again, right? I mean, or do it again if it was amazing.
We did a show. I don't know if you ever saw it. Me and my buddy David, who you met here, we did a show called Biltong for Breakfast. And we did about like 5 episodes of it. And then he had a new job that took him away and he was doing all the video work. So it was like, fuck it, we're not doing it anymore. When we were doing that, the only reason we did it We bought extra camera gear and all this shit to do this thing is because one day he came over, we both got fucking drunk, and we made these sticky Chinese style, Korean style quail legs on the grill, and we ate every fucking bit of it, and he's like, I could have had 1,000 of those. And then we're like, I know there was gochujang in it, and I know I basted it at the end so it wouldn't burn, but I could never do it again. And I'm like, I'm not going to write it down. I know my weakness. If we video it, at least I'll know what I've done. Sure. You know?
David, if David's a riot. If no one's ever met David, he's a riot. He's so fun.
All right, man. Well, hey, I appreciate you being with us today. I'll have you back anytime. And it really was your idea, and I'm going to do that. You'll see an email come out today. You can ignore it because you were just on, but it's going to be, one, fucking give me content. Two, let's get you signed up to get you, you know, everybody else, get them on. And I am going to give priority to the council members who haven't either been on for a very long time as a guest or have never been on as a guest, because I think this will help bring in more content for you guys to work on. Because I will say that creating a segment is kind of like creating a podcast, and sometimes you're just brain locked, and it's like playing ping pong without a partner. There's no rebound off of it. So I think we could get all of you guys producing more content if we got more questions. So please send them in, guys. Remember the formula to send a question in for Ken or for anybody on the council. Jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com is the email. TSPC in the subject line. Go TSPC expert in the subject line. Question, one sentence with a question mark. I promise you can do it. Then hit return. Then give me all the details that you want. And that way I'll know what you're asking. Chef Ken or another council member will know what you're asking. And more importantly, you'll know what you're asking, because I came up with that rule early on, because I would get these questions and go, I read the whole thing like 3 times and go, I'm not stupid. And I don't know what you're asking me. And so I don't know how to formulate the answer, you know? So if you guys do that for us, we'll all be able to do better for you. Bro, hey, thank you for being with us today. Yeah.
I'm gonna pick on you 1 second. I know the value of emails like that, but having one eye. So okay. I'm trying to read my emails, and I'm like, what the fuck is going on? So it's
yeah, that's
fun,
my other thing. Like the giant block of wall of text with no paragraph breaks.
Yeah.
Like I can read that on a paper. Don't give me that shit on a screen. I can't do it. You know, I just can't.
Jack, it's been fun, man. We'll chat soon.
All right, man. Take care. All right, guys, real quick, let me wrap up. Thank you guys for being with us today. I really appreciate it. If you guys want to support my show, one of the ways that you can do that and help us out, no matter what you buy, is to do your online shopping starting at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. Today's item of the day, we are continuing with the top selling items from last year. And today's item of the day was one of the absolute top selling items of last year. It was the Gigator propane weed burning torch. This was the 7th or 8th top selling item. I can't off the top of my head remember, but it was definitely a top 10 last year. And I didn't bring it around until mid-November. And it sold really well. And it's, you know, in consort with my cover crop course. Using flaming is one way to help terminate cover crop, and I really wanted to get something out. I'm sure that drove some of the sales, but there's a ton of things you can do with a good torch. This is not a little bitty hand torch. This is a badass, high-powered torch designed for weed flaming, but it does a lot of other things. It's a torch. It burns stuff, so that means when you're going to start your grill up, you don't need a chimney. You don't need lighter fluid. Trust me, you hit some charcoal with this or some wood chunks with this, they're going to burn. You got to do it. You burn like a big pile of debris or something, it's going to burn, right? It will do it. But here's one of the coolest things for it. Those of you that do your gardening using weed blocker, you get one of these torches and you heat it up and then you back it down. But that ring, the bell on the end of it, is the perfect size for the average potted plant to go in. And when you cut weed blocker, it inevitably frays and it's a mess and it's a pain in the ass and what have you. When you melt it, it's nylon, so it basically fixes the edges so that they don't run. And you get a perfect little hole that your plant fits perfectly in. That's just one of the cool things about it. It's a great tool. Also consider becoming a member of the support brigade. If you do that, you know, you get discounts to some really cool stuff, and you can help us out that way too. I appreciate everybody tuning in today. It's one of our longer episodes. It was a great discussion with Ken on a wide variety of topics. And again, I could use questions for Ken and the rest of the expert council. Send them in to me. And tomorrow we'll have an expert council show.
They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.